This is Bob Harris.
Jim Katz.
Gene Allen.
And we're sitting at Warner Hollywood, where we did the dub and the restoration work on My Fair Lady. We're looking at the floral prologue at the moment, and without boring you too much, I've been rather elected to tell you how we recreated the opening of the film. We had major problems because where Warner Brothers would historically save most everything they could get their hands on, when the rights reverted on My Fair Lady from Warner's to CBS in 1970 or 71, there were hundreds and hundreds of cartons that were shipped to CBS. And CBS isn't a film company, it's a TV company. And they junked the majority of the cartons, including the backgrounds and all the original material on the main titles. So what you're seeing now are the prologue of the flowers from a YCM black and white separations. And they were recreated that way. They look a little mangy around the edges on a large screen. And then we go into the main titles, which all had to be recreated digitally. And I believe this was the first time that digital has ever been used, certainly in film restoration. To recreate the titles, we went to the YCM masters, which were dupes of dupes of dupes, and selected a single frame, which was input into the computers at Cinesite, which is an Eastman Kodak company. And each of these titles was cleaned up, processed, and brought back to what we felt was as close as we could get to the original condition. And there was not equipment available at that time to input 65 millimeter and output 65 millimeter. So we had to input 65 and output VistaVision, and then do an optical enlargement going from VistaVision back to 65 millimeter. And it was an extremely intensive product, which was created again by Cinesite and a company called iMagica, which is a wonderful optical for us in large format. We actually made 10 frames of each of the titles and then jogged back and forth between two frames as not to get stagnant grain on a 50% exposure. And iMagica re-encoded all of these dissolves properly, including those from which you have no title, and going to the first title, which is the Warner logo. And then eventually we went from this entire roll to the first scene of actual production photography, which is again flowers, then you pull back and you have people going down the stairs, which you'll see in a moment. But
today we would, at 2.8K, not get the results that we have on this.
Jack Warner's title had a gigantic black blob under the J and A, which looked like you could drive a Buick through it, which I think has been said before.
In that I actually shot those titles, and Pacific Title was nice enough to let me sit with a camera and the knobs moving in and out, making those compositions. I must say that that's exactly what we had done. It couldn't be any better. That was the colors we wanted, which was interesting. White on white is not an easy thing to do, and those are white titles on a white background, so that it was delicate for you, I'm sure, to be able to make that work.
You know, the materials were in such terrible shape that we actually thought of reshooting them, actually putting flowers on a stage and actually trying to duplicate what was duplicated.
I would have killed you.
But we had no choice until we suddenly found the way that
we could do it digitally.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that really needs to be made very clear here is the quality of the production values, the lighting, the cinematography, the production design. All of the elements that make a film really extraordinary were there in 1964, and our job was to bring them back and make them look like they did in 1964. But the film is so amazing in its scope and in its size and in its perfection that we're in a long-term debt to the craftspeople that created a film like this.
One of the big problems we have is getting detail in the blacks. And in these scenes, they're in formal dress and where the sets are sort of muted, it was very difficult to achieve that. And
it was all very carefully controlled core color. The contrast between the opening and the flowers and the brightness and freshness, and then go to Covent Garden, which is sort of grays and browns, intermixed with the wealthy coming out of the opera in those blacks, as you say. But what I see, the blacks are marvelous.
Gene, was this set created on a single soundstage?
Single soundstage. Used to be stage 7, and they changed the number. I don't know the number now, but it was a one-story stage that was lifted to two stories by taking the one and putting jacks under it and lifted it up. And then they went in, and these were for the old Errol Flynn sea movies. And so then they put in a pit of a complete, that complete stage at it. So I used all three layers for this. The bottom thing is below ground level.
So this would have been filled with water.
This would, or a floor over the top of it, not used at all. But if the space was there. So we took the flooring off, had this old deep swimming pool, and found means to get the carriages and people and all down a level.
How much pre-production time did you have to build all this?
Maybe 3 months. We had good time. I had a chance to get it designed in those first days and then get it built, because Cuco expected me to be on his right hip pocket. If he was on that lot, I was just a foot behind and a foot to the right. He counted on my being with him and all things, so it was, I would have to do this before Cuco arrived on the thing at lunchtimes and the evenings of the actual designing and constructing, although constructing would go on during the day.
But the set was up all the time, wasn't it?
The set was up before we ever started.
But they didn't strike it after you finished sequences? And then,
Not at all, until I changed it for Damn, 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 I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face, I changed it, and then we also changed some things for the pub crawl.
Mm-hmm.
But it stayed primarily as it was. Harry Stradling, the cinematographer, did a marvelous job. It's a big set to light. The lights were up a long way away.
One of the interesting things, you mentioned Harry Stradling. I believe he also photographed Pygmalion in 1937, 38?
Yeah.
That was an amazing span.
You know, another interesting thing was there were so many problems with adapting the music, because there was a previous version or a previous attempt by Rodgers and Hammerstein to do this, and then finally when Lerner and Lowe came in to do it, they had to adhere to the contracts of the Shaw estate, where they had to use dialogue from the play in the lyrics of the song.
That was a genius of Lerner. You read the play, you read Shaw's words, and there they are in his songs. And that was by contract.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah.
Interesting, those columns that, and the real ones in London, Covent Garden, the pigeons are up above, so I naturally duplicated the look of the pigeon stuff on the little rim at the bottom of those. And when Audrey first came out and the pupil asked her to sit there in that corner to play a scene, she very carefully touched it to find out if that was real.
She thought it was actual pigeon.
Yeah, it was. We had a good painter.
You see the glare of that white on his lapel there?
It's very, very difficult to get a rich true black and a rich full white with detail in the whites.
That may be a lot of trouble, but you've done it, and it is what it should be. It should have that.
That's the idea of film restoration, is to make it what it was supposed to be.
And it's very, very time-consuming. You know, it's very easy to send purchase orders out to optical houses and the like, but if you don't know what you're getting back, they're the ones who are doing the restoration. And this is probably why we're loved so dearly in this town.
Warner was always very unhappy with white whites and for those titles, because he said, you know, about the third time you run it, the scratches start. But we had a rule with Cuco. We used white whites.
Well, you know, one of the problems that we have constantly is that once we put all this work into these restorations, and especially this one, we make a certain number of 70mm prints that we send out to the theaters, and they're just butchered so quickly that right now there are probably, I think, 2 really good prints of My Fair Lady, and one's at the Motion Picture Academy, and the other one is with us at this point. But we try and at least put one somewhere so we know we can call on it. And the prints on this were, what were they,
$22,000
a piece.
The Academy's print was a gift of CBS and Deluxe Laboratories. It would be nice if for every restoration the Academy got a print.
I've given little talks at various film festivals with My Fair Lady. I must say they're not this quality usually when they run them. I don't know where they get them. I know the last time, it looked like we weren't going to have the last reel, but they found it in a truck somewhere and got it there delivered just in time to finish the showing.
Well, there's a film festival, not in the States, which shall go unmentioned. We heard a tale that they apparently run My Fair Lady last year or 2 years ago, and the first half was 70mm, and they didn't have the rest of the film in 70mm, so they ran part of it in 35mm. but they were missing a couple of reels in 35, so they ran a couple of reels in VHS projected. So they kind of had the whole film.
Don't sit there crooning like a bilious pigeon.
Ow!
Look at her, a prisoner of the gutters. Condemned by every syllable she utters. By right, she should be taken out and hung. For the cold-blooded murder of the English tongue.
Ow!
Heavens, what a sound. This is what the British population calls an elementary education.
Hamza, I think you picked a poor example.
Did I? Hear them down in Soho Square, dropping H's everywhere, speaking English any way they like. You, sir, did you go to school?
What do you take me for, a fool?
Well, no one taught him take instead of tyke. Hear a Yorkshireman, or worse, hear a Cornishman converse. They'd rather hear a choir singing flat. Chickens cackling in a barn, just like this one.
Gone!
Gone. I ask you, sir, what sort of word is that?
It's ow and gone that keep her in her place. Not her wretched clothes and dirty face. Why can't the English teach their children how to speak? This verbal class distinction by now should be antique. If you spoke as she does, sir, instead of the way you do, why, you might be selling flowers too.
Beg your pardon.
An Englishman's way of speaking absolutely classifies him. The moment he talks, he makes some other Englishman despise him. One common language I'm afraid we'll never get. Oh, why can't
we? Well, no, that Harrison refused to sing to playbacks, so his mic is under that tie.
We had some funny experiences with that doing the soundtrack because, as far as we know, and I think, wasn't it John Bonner from Warner Hollywood?
John Bonner, and we were sitting there with Bob Litt and noticed that everyone's lyrics were slightly rubbery, except for Rex Harrison. And his vocals, as far as synchronization, were dead on. But he had a very strident, a totally different recorded sound. And, you know, Jim and I were sitting there, and we said, well, can we stop a second? And we look at Bob, and we said, you know, what are we looking at here? He's in dead sync. And Bob said, electronic microphone.
Do you think he was wired?
Did they have wiring? You know, were they using electronic microphones in 1964? And of course, if you had a question like that in those days, you would call John Bonner, who knew everything, and John came in and said, oh yes, it was the first picture that...
It was, and also we could have been arrested because we didn't have a license and you were broadcasting. There were some complications. QCOR would never allow anybody to say cut, but in the case with Harrison singing those numbers, he allowed me to look at the man at the black box moving the switches, and when he made a face, I'd tap QCOR's shoulder and he'd say cut, because we had just picked up a Burbank taxi cab and other...
Police calls. And the other interesting thing was in one of the scenes later in the film when Rex Harrison sits down in one of the big easy chairs, you hear this whoosh sound with all the air going out of the cushion.
All the tracks had to be cleaned up. I mean, the tracks were extraordinary for 1964, but the listeners should take into consideration and understand that in 1964, most of the projectors, not necessarily the 70 millimeters, which mostly were from the mid to late 50s, but the 35 millimeter projectors were from the 30s and 40s, and the speakers were from the 30s and 40s. And those speakers would hide a multitude of sins in the soundtracks. We had things like the whooshing of the seed, and at one point on the stage at Warner Hollywood, you could actually hear a fly going around in the production track.
But this is happening in many other ways. A lot of things are showing up in films that weren't meant to be seen. They were just disguised by the lack of clarity. The technology today is revealing everything.
You got to hand it to Harrison, though, to be able to do that live and follow the time span that was allowed for that music and all. And of course, he'd had that experience on the stage.
Well, he also had a live body singing back to him, and here he was dealing with playback and someone who's...
No, he wouldn't sing it to playback.
No, but she was singing.
Oh, she
playback.
Did, yes. Yeah. The other interesting thing is normally a director shoots the woman first because they get tired, but it was Harrison that he would always shoot first because he got tired before Audrey. And his first take was usually the best.
Hello, this is Marnie Nixon, and I was the singing voice of Audrey Hepburn playing the role of Eliza Doolittle in My Fair Lady. The audition process was rather interesting. I was actually doing concert with Andre Previn with the New York Philharmonic one day, and I said to Andre, this was in New York, and I lived in Los Angeles, and I said, Andre, you know, I just went to the studio and I auditioned in Cecil Beaton's bungalow with George Cukor there. I auditioned to play the voice of Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady. And he said, you what? And he hadn't been told that they were holding auditions, and he was a musical director, and he wasn't there, and he was sort of upset about that. In the meantime, I called the studio here in New York City, and I said I would like to re-audition for My Fair Lady, and they said, oh, I'm sorry, we can't have anyone from California doing any of the singing for My Fair Lady. We have to have real authentic singers, don't you understand? So I felt really put down. So prior to that, obviously, I had come into the studio and I had sung a few songs and they had said thank you very much. So several months later, they held real auditions, which meant that they called you into the studio and they didn't want anybody who was doing the listening to see any of the people auditioning for the part, because sometimes they hire with their eyes, not knowing, rather than just with their ears. And so I came in with a bunch of people. We walked into the back door, into the booth, and I was number whatever, and auditioned, and then I got the part. And I think what they do is just they hear you're suggested by various people. I had been working so much in Los Angeles as a dubber that they just sort of automatically, I guess, thought of me and called me in. But there were others that auditioned too. On Wouldn't It Be Loverly, it was a little bit different. I went to the sound stage while they were actually doing the filming and was watching her do the whole song to her own track. She filmed that to her track. And it was only afterwards that then I had to come back to earphones and with her voice in one ear and me singing in the other ear on the Warner Brothers soundstage and patch in my voice, and I tried to do as much of her personality and accent and acting that was her particular thing, and then I had to re-record that to the film, which is a more difficult process. I was not supposed to get credit at all. I was sworn to secrecy. I don't know the actual words, but I know that it was a little bit frightening to me because at that point, the atmosphere in the air of musicals, of the public, was that they had grown up a little bit to understand that dubbing was going on. In The King and I, nobody really knew that anybody had ever been dubbed. Everybody was shocked.
Interestingly enough, on this particular scene, we put together a track of Audrey singing, over 200 sound cuts. Certainly validated Jack Warner's concern for not using her and using Marty Nixon. Although she put her heart and soul into the singing, Audrey just didn't have the range to carry the music as it was written.
When you hear the original tracks, I mean, we're actually going back in history when we find these elements, and thank goodness Warner's kept them. Had they been sent over to CBS, they probably would have been junked. It's interesting listening to Audrey try to sing them, because her personality totally comes through, because she's constantly saying, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, could I please try that again? I'm so sorry to be taking your time.
In this kind of a project, you want to make sure that you have a voice that can sustain the emotion, that a piece that is written almost like an opera and very specifically in that range. So anyway, when people knew that it was Audrey Hepburn that had been hired, everybody thought, aha, maybe we're being put upon here by being told it's Audrey Hepburn when it's really not. It's Audrey Hepburn plus somebody else.
It was just all in the phrasing. When we put the sequence together of the song, we had to bring Marnie in to bail her out. But it's very interesting to see it because she did such a wonderful job in the film.
You did get Marnie back on the restoration?
Well, she didn't come in and do any recording, but when we put that sound together, the last phrases, Audrey couldn't carry, so we brought Marnie's voice in to get us out of the sequence. But we didn't use it in the film. We used it as a curiosity. I think it was on the laser disc, and we ran it in 70 millimeter at screenings.
I call this the Not a Brass Farthing scene.
Yeah.
By the way, this was directed by a very brilliant young director, Gene Allen.
Really?
All of this section, all of the atmosphere here in the...
Whatever became of him?
I don't know. The last I heard was that he just had his 57th wedding anniversary, so he's pretty well along.
So he must be really old.
Yeah. Sad.
Well, his work will live on forever, won't it?
All of this.
She looks like.
I know her. Come on, I'll find her.
One of the things that's really incredible about this film is the detail and the authenticity in the production design and the creation of the sets and the set dressings. I have a friend who is very interested in this particular period in time, costumes and things of that sort. And when she saw the film for the first time after the restoration, started telling me about the original designers of the wallpaper in Higgins' study, and she was just amazed that the production designer was able to literally recreate history to the perfection that it was done. So, Gene, you must have spent at least a weekend researching.
Was that
Listen, well, let me tell you what that is. We actually went to London and got the original blocks for that wallpaper and had it printed in London. The actual period paper.
It's incredible.
Yes, a picture like this requires tremendous research, and it's not that difficult to get good research that, given the time and the money, you can recreate the atmosphere of the period. Nothing was invented. It was all from research. I went to London to look at Covent Garden, but the rest of it, you know, the great Warner Brothers research department that they had, and there's books, and Beaton, of course, with his costumes. I won't speak for him, but I will say that a fabulous job was done.
And then you photograph it in Super Panavision 70, and you have a situation in which every detail shows.
He got a lot of credit for some of the things that you did, Gene, didn't he?
Unfortunately, the history of Mr. Beaton is that he often claiming work that he didn't really do. He gets a credit on this costume and production design by, well, a production designer is the individual like William Cameron Menzies that works with the director and picks the shots and works with the cameraman and does all of the stuff, builds the sets and all of that. And that's what I did on this picture. But I did get art direction, single card credit for it, which I knew going in that was it, because Beaton was on the picture ahead of Pukler even join it. They were thinking that they were going to have Minnelli, and so that he got that credit. But it's not a true credit. And then he did give the impression that he had done the sets, which he did not, one of them.
But I think that was probably left over from his involvement in the designing of the stage musical, wasn't it?
Correct. And he gave the impression that he designed the stage musical. He didn't. Oliver Smith designed the stage musical. He did the costumes for that musical. But he gave everyone the impression that he had done both.
Now, how many vowel sounds do you think you've heard altogether?
I believe I counted.
Jink, could you give us a little background about the set that we're looking at now? Because it seems that there are multiple areas and backs and fronts and great intricacy to it.
There was, and having worked with George Pukler for many years, I understood the space that he needs to play the scene. You read the scenes, and I would diagram all the scenes. And then the set would evolve from actual shot by shot by shot that I would lay out prior to ever designing the set, so that we covered every bit and piece of what was needed for the story, the unfolding of the story. You don't want to get bored staying in just one room playing all of those scenes. So we had all of these little alcoves and hallways and stairways and second floor and even a third floor, all on the same stage, not on the same level, but it looks as though they're all connected. But double doors so you can get your camera through.
But this foyer, did it actually, it went into Higgins's study the way that it looks like it's
connected? Yes, all of this is actually a piece. All of it's connected.
So Higgins' house was his house?
Higgins' house was his house. As soon as you went up the stairs, then we had another section for that, when you picked up where I came on up the stairs, duplicating the stairways. And you'll notice something nobody's ever mentioned, but you'd never look out and see outside of a window. There's not a backing used in this picture, other than Covent Garden, a big gray for that morning shot.
But you had to build the main staircase, because in the Poor Professor Higgins number,
yes,
where they're looking up.
They do. That stairway is there. Then when we duplicate that on another floor, we have a pit, so it goes down off the end of the stage. And then we duplicated that big window that's at the end of the stairway and had that on the other section. So you never get caught that you're not actually moving. But that little room, you go out and you actually go back to that hallway that we'd seen earlier. They're all connected.
Do you have any recollection of what it actually cost to create these sets in 1964?
No, I don't. I'm terrible about that, but I did not have a budget. Jack Warner and Charlie Greenlaw, who was the head of production, never asked for a budget. We just had to build them. They had confidence that I knew what I was doing, that they would work for Q-Corps, that I had a reputation of never building more than you need, but still having sufficient for George Pukler to shoot. He liked to shoot in continuity, so in this big room with the library, I actually built the walls, the two-story walls, on railroad tracks so that they could slide in and out easily, so Harry Stradling could turn around and shoot a reverse and put the walls back in. And the stationary part was the part there in that hallway. That those always stayed, but the other walls could move in and out on railroad tracks.
Well, legend has it that Jack Warner went to New York, saw the show, and said that he was going to make the movie and bought the rights from CBS. And I think there was only a 5-year term on the project. All materials from the film reverted back to CBS, which was extraordinary in those days.
The reason Cukor shot this movie was because Minnelli, who was the first choice, wanted a percentage. And Jack Warner said there is no percentage. He only had 50% to begin with. CBS had the other half. And so that they finally brought Q-Corps in for a flat salary. And I came in with Q-Corps. The agents actually had told Q-Corps when they went for the first meeting with Warner, don't mention Gene Allen, because Cecil Beaton would be very upset if he thought a known designer was coming in on the picture. So the meeting went on, it was almost over, and Jack Warner took a piece of paper out of his pocket and he asked George Cooper, now about Gene Allen. So Jack Warner brought my name up and I went on.
One time I was on the soundstage and there was George Cukor telling me how to do certain songs, how to sing them, what the motivation of the actress is, what she's thinking, what the background is like. Then you have a speech expert who is now telling me how to do the Cockney in the proper Cockney way, and he's giving me advice. Then you have Audrey, who is waiting for the person that was playing her father, Stanley Holloway, who is this magnificent actor, who had not arrived on the set yet. Audrey was waiting for him to arrive because she was supposed to be playing his daughter. And every Cockney accent is a little bit different. There's a little bit variance according to which block you've been born and raised on. So she was waiting for him to give her the exact pronunciation of various things before she could give it to me. You had the speech expert, then you had Audrey explaining to me, or I was by osmosis, I could tell the way when she would sing it, I could tell what she was thinking. I did not know what the actual scene was at that point, where she was walking to or anything. And then you had Alan J. Lerner, who was the lyricist. You had him being present, and he would explain why he chose certain words, and he was, this is a long story, but it's very funny. He, at that point, he was trying to not smoke. He was a big smoker, and he was on a lot of pills in order to keep him from smoking, and he was trying to use his discipline, which didn't seem to be working, and he had white gloves on his hands, on both his hands, so he wouldn't bite his fingernails. But these white gloves were lined with plastic so that they rattled. And he uses a lot of hand gestures when he's talking. And he describes things where you and I, well, maybe not me, I tend to go on and on. But he describes things at great length. He's very verbal, obviously. And while he's describing things, he would be wiggling his hands around, if you could hear this, you know, just with this rattle, rattle, rattle. And you could see the fingers just in great nervousness, clenching. And finally, he would rip off the gloves and then bite his fingernails, which he wasn't supposed to be doing. And then he would go on and on. So getting back to then, what Andre Previn would do, he would be a great synthesizer. He would listen to all of this, them telling me, and I was told at one point during West Side Story, Saul Chaplin said to me once, he said, Marnie, you know, we hire you, we don't hire you for your voice, we hire you for your iron nerves. And so here I was standing there listening to all of this, and Andre Previn comes around behind me, knowing that I'm a musician, and he whispers to me, just sing it softer. And so then I sang it softer, whatever they were talking about. And then they were all saying, oh, isn't she wonderful? She took each one of our suggestions and just did it perfectly. So that's Andre Previn. He kind of can put it all together. I was very disturbed that Audrey Hepburn thought that perhaps she didn't win the Academy Award because it got to be known that she was being dubbed, and that that had taken away from the impetus of her winning the Academy Award. From my observation, it was also a sympathetic vote for Julie Andrews, who was not hired in the first place, who had originated the role on Broadway. And everybody was sort of, it was like a boycott. Well, if they didn't hire Julie Andrews, who could have done her own singing, we shouldn't vote for whoever, you know, did it. I think it was kind of a sympathetic vote that way. And in the end, it was very ironic that Julie Andrews, who had not been hired, had done Mary Poppins at the same time, and she was nominated at the same in the same year at the Academy Awards for the best actress in Mary Poppins, and that she won the Academy Award. And I think that probably because they didn't give me credit, then in the end it kind of snowballed to everybody getting behind the bandwagon and wanting to make sure that other people got credit if they were doing dubbing. The interesting thing is that it doesn't take away from the value of the picture. I mean, we see that people get credit for makeup, for doing stunts. Do you think about that when you're looking at the picture? Oh, well, that's not really them doing the stunts. Well, the play's the thing, as Shakespeare said.
See, how did Audrey and Rex get on? Did they get on well on the set?
Very well. There was never a moment that caused any problem whatsoever. It's interesting because Audrey had early told me that she likes to see the left side of her face. I always set up the camera shots with Harry Stradling on the one hand, with Cukor during rehearsals. So I would always arrange that Audrey would come up and so we could shoot that side of her face. Interesting enough, it's also the side of face that Rex Harrison likes. So if you watch this carefully through it, you watch that battle of the faces. Now here they are both on the wrong side. Of course, Audrey puts her hand up to help whatever she didn't like about it, I don't know. So they played scenes where they were both looking straight out. But
having done the show for so many years with Julie Andrews and then having Audrey get the part, was there any discussion about that?
Or? Not at all. They both relied heavily on George Cukor for protecting them in making a movie. And as I say, he even changed his methods of shooting a shot like this. He'd shoot Rex first. Then he would, when you go into a close-up of him and not her.
By the way, if you look at Rex's tie in these scenes, you can actually see when they're shooting a musical number and when they're not, because his tie looks like it obviously has a microphone in it. Now it doesn't.
Yeah, it has that kind of twisted off natural look right now.
Mm-hmm. You can see where it's pliable, and when he's singing, his tie is totally stiff.
7 and 6 to start life with as a lady in a shop. If you refuse this offer, you would be the most ungrateful.
That's all part of that first floor plan.
Mm-hmm.
The stairway was included. And that mirror light that you see back there, that sort of Art Nouveau window, I duplicated when I did the pit with the other sets.
I don't understand what the word you're talking about.
Well, could I put it more plainly or
the detail in this film is... I don't know if it's ever really been duplicated.
Off to the bathroom.
I had about 35 set designers working drawing. Had a terrific assistant, Jim McGuire, that to this day I regret not seeing his name appear up there with mine. He was a tremendous help. But see, you come up out of pits and things to make that kind of a stairway look like it's all part of the same building.
Well, titles were historically very sparse. In the teens and 20s, you'd have two or three cards, and then it finally got up into the 60s where you might have 15 cards, which still wasn't enough. And now you can have a 15-minute feature and 75 or 80 minutes of end titles.
Yeah, in the technical term for that is, it was always in the old days, those early days, called the technical card. And it usually started with cinematographer and so forth up there.
Well, in the early days, they had whoever was head of that department got a credit along with the person who actually did the work. Like
absolutely.
At Paramount, Hal Pereira got a credit on almost every Hitchcock picture they did there at the time, and then subsequently we saw Henry Bumstead or whoever did the picture at the time, Bob Boyle.
He's got a credit over mine that he never had anything to do with it. I did it all overseas, but under that system.
Mm-hmm.
So they all had Oscars, quite a few. Cedric Gibbons, of course, at MGM, but he was more involved with the thing. Lyle Wheeler later on over at Fox.
Come on. Take your clothes off. Come on, girl, do as you're told. Take your clothes off. Here, come on, girl, take this. Ow! 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 Ow!
It's incredible when you go back to a shot of Wilfred Hyde White or looking down into Pekin's study with those oriental carpets. With the quality of the cinematography, you can almost see the makeup, the threads in the carpets, the weaves. It is so unbelievably sharp. And that's not just the camera system, it's the cinematographer.
Right. This was on another piece of the stage. Now he'll go now and be in this two-story part of this thing. But I think the impression the people get is that it was all one house.
Well, it's quite incredible because, you know, when these films were released in the 60s, they were called road shows and they were reserved seats and they came out at holiday times and people would book months in advance.
They could play in the theater for a year without stopping.
They would book months in advance and it would really be an event as if they were going to the theater. It's too bad that this doesn't exist today. But we're in an era of billion-dollar pictures and 3 weeks and you're out.
But I can't believe that this industry can't afford to save those magnificent films that can be saved. That there's a question of not spending the money to do it or for whatever reasons. It just seems that if you look at the big picture, it would be ridiculous not to have these around in another 100 years or 50 years.
Well, this is a problem that we deal with all the time. In the 80s, when the multinational companies were taking over the studios like Sony and Time Warner and Rashusister, however you pronounce it, at Universal, and so on, News Corp at Fox, the first thing they asked was, what's in the library? What do you have in the library? And that was always a major factor in determining the value of the company. And here we are now, where to spend $1 million to save a great movie is a big deal because we seem to be held to the same standards as new movies. If these don't make their money back in 20 days, then they say the exercise is a failure. We like to amortize our work over 20 to 50 years. And hopefully there'll be more people around who understand that and not figure that this is not the quick turnaround that new pictures have.
You know, all of the restorations that we've done have gone into the black very rapidly. There are only a couple that haven't done it theatrically, but as soon as they get video, they're doing millions and millions and millions of copies.
But that shouldn't be part of why it's done.
Oh, we agree.
That should be not a part of it at all. It should be that the pictures should be restored and then means found to keep them in that restored.
Well, we have the means, whether it's, you know, any number of...
Run another print?
Well, not running another print necessarily, but we have the storage facilities now, which can take them down to, you know, anywhere from 30, 40, 45 degrees down to well below zero. So these elements can last forever. And if you do the restorations on Estar-based film, which don't have a chemical breakdown, literally they can last forever. We go in, we generally make new black and white separation masters. We're making large format interpositives. But the problem with the large format films is that sometimes a studio or the owner will say, let's restore it, and they'll end up restoring it in a substandard format, like 35mm, which means that you can never, ever go back and create a 70mm print. And not to have a 70mm print of My Fair Lady, I think, would be unthinkable at this point.
And also, you know, we try to create a new negative. We call it the restoration negative, and that is the element that will hopefully last and enable the picture to be seen in perpetuity. But when you're dealing with a negative that has had maybe 300 prints made off it, which was the case in all of these roadshow pictures, you really have a lot of wear and tear. You have duplicate elements inserted into the picture from, in this case, 1964 all the way up to 1990. The reason that they did that was because they wanted to maintain the quality of the show in every city that it played in. They wanted Kansas City to see the same picture that they saw in New York, but it was really very, very hard on the negative.
Well, there were also no duplicate materials during that period from which you could derive a duplicate negative.
Quiet living man. But
there's a woman in your life, and your sabbatical is through. In a line that never ends, come an army of her friends, come to jabber and to chatter and to tell her what the matter is with you. She'll have a booming, boisterous family who will descend on you en masse. She'll have a large Wagnerian mother with a voice that shatters glass. There a woman in your life?
Hey, how's the sort of computer, boy? I'll say this to you. Never.
There a woman in your life?
All right, now you go sit up there.
Take a look at Rex's tie there. It looks like he's got a tube stuck up the middle of it.
I shall never let a woman in my life.
remember, drinks to be paid for or not drunk.
This is the only set that was done on an exterior. This is on the back lot at Warner Brothers. They just took fill it with dirt and dug some ditches and had the workmen working to kind of give a little freshness from the old Warner Brothers films.
So this is really an exterior?
This is an exterior.
Just for exercise. It's not worth it. Takes up your whole day. Ah, don't worry, boys. We'll get out of this somehow.
How do you think you're going to do that?
We were able to build the sets, and all the sets are new. They weren't taking an old set and revamping it, but this required to be out on the street so that you could get the band and the women's groups, so that we just took what was there and then changed the signs and the colors in all of the buildings.
One of the interesting things about My Fair Lady is that its restoration was really video driven. It occurred because 2 years in the running, CBS or CBS Fox attempted to make Laserdisc versions of the film, and they had virtually no color, they were out of focus, they were partially squeezed, and 2 years running, they won the worst Laserdisc of the Year award from the Laserdisc newsletter. And that's when we got involved, and there were two gentlemen from CBS, Ken Ross and Ken Horowitz, who were working with us really on a day-to-day basis. And very much like your creation of the sets, basically they said, make this as perfect as you possibly can. We want it to last forever. It's one of our major assets. Working with them was wonderful because whatever we needed, we were able to do.
Somebody should be mentioned as never is. Hermes Pan was the choreographer.
Sure.
And he was Mr. Fred Astaire's ally for all those years and looked and talked precisely as would Fred Astaire. But he would take and work on these things out on a grass field somewhere and we'd tape them out. And so then I would know what kind of set we might need for some of the numbers. The other ones are in the houses and all weren't, but, or at Covent Garden. But for instance, this one he taped out and worked with the principals. And so I was able to kind of find some place that could expand to the point that he needed it.
Which is really interesting because the set was derived from the design of the action as opposed to taking the action and placing it in a predetermined set.
Right. Many of the others were because the sets were known, and he worked within that.
Why, there's the lucky man now, the Honorable Alfie Doolittle.
What are you doing in Eliza's house?
A former residence.
It's interesting when you look at this film, you see so many of the Warner Brothers stock players that were around in the 40s. And
yeah, fewer though than some of the other pictures I did at Warner's. Warner's always used their stock company. But Cukor tried to get as original faces as he could.
Well, he certainly has some original ones.
And brought them in from British colony here in Southern California.
Well, the Ascot scene especially. I mean, there's some great faces in there.
Go on.
Then this morning I get a message from her. She wants her things sent over to 27A Wimpole Street, care of Professor Riggins. And what things does she want?
What?
A birdcage and a Chinese fan. But, she says, never mind about sending
That's
any
another
clothes.
Thing that young Gene Allen directed was that whole Ascot Gavotte, that dance number. Well, that was Bob Surtees came in, you know, famous Bob Surtees came in and shot the second unit with me, only because we'd worked together in other pictures, but I was fortunate to have a guy like Bob come in and we did that number.
What was the grass made of?
It was a grass mat. You know, you're caught in something that's interesting is that how real do you go? You have a famous stage play, a hit, and how much do you open it up and change it, or how much do you kind of compromise to make it so it still has a feeling of theatrical?
That's the only problem that we had in the film, we could not get a green, a true grass green out of that. It just wouldn't work.
Yeah, it didn't photograph that way. I didn't like it. I would rather have had sod in there under normal conditions. But, you know, when you do sod, then you've got to have lights on the stage all night long to imitate sunlight so the grass will stay green.
I wouldn't have thought of that.
And so it was just a... And then, production people felt that we weren't going to see too much of it anyway. But you always do.
One of the major problems in that sequence, again, it's the black and white costume that Audrey is wearing. The gentleman in either black or gray or a blue-gray. And you want to keep the white pure, you want to keep the black pure. And that almost...
That turns the rest of it to bluish.
Yeah, it sets things up and sets it in a different direction if you have a slightly faded negative element. And one of the challenges in this film was to get that material to look like what it was supposed to look like and be accurate.
By the way, those sets are... All the wood you see is actual hardwood. Be it plywood, but it's all that's...
So who designed those contraptions? Are those all yours? Or?
Yeah, we got with special effects people and got books and research and QCOR and everybody got together and said this would look good. We exaggerated the points. You do things where things turn. The cameraman takes a piece of chalk and makes a little white mark on a edge of something so that you can see it turning around. There's all kinds of little tricks that go with this.
Now, is that one of those medieval Iron Maidens that they've got here with the spikes that go into her?
But it was perfect.
I got tired of hearing her say, "Aye, hey, that went on and on.
Over and over, from sun up to sundown, even during meals, you'll exhaust yourself. When will it stop?
When she does it properly, of course.
Everything is pretty well evenly lit because of the movement that QCOR always would like to have. It's when you're doing comedy to light the set.
Well, once it was pre-lit, it must have been pretty easy to start work in the morning,
right,
wasn't it?
Yeah. Slight changes when you go in for close-ups. But to do a big shot like this is kind of interesting. And you've done it restored in such a way that you see every detail.
Well, it looks like there's a partial ceiling on that.
Wherever we open...
Is that just a little bit of a lip?
No, that would be a partial ceiling.
Of course it's a blackguard, Pickering. Whether he is or not, I'm afraid we'll have some...
Was that a real fire in the fireplace? Or was
real
it a gas fan?
That was gas.
Can you tell us anything about the bit players or any of the other actors?
Sterling Holloway was a master. I'm delighted that they cast him in this part.
Stanley Holloway. Yeah.
Stanley. Did I say...
You said Sterling.
Stanley.
They look different.
I saw his son the other day on some television show, and he said... What a great thing for his old man to end his career with is that part. They had other suggestions to play it, but he's terrific. He was absolutely hard of hearing, couldn't hear a word of anybody said, but he was enough of an actor to know by watching lips when it was his turn to talk.
He was an old music hall guy in England.
He was.
Is it true that they were going to bring in or were thinking of bringing in Cary Grant to do Higgins and that... He refused and said something like, unless you bring in Rex Harrison, I'm not even going to go see the movie?
Absolutely true, as far as I've read. That's a well-known part of this. But they had several suggestions for Harrison, none of which, you know, he is Professor Higgins. How could you even think of anyone else? Of course, if Rex was saying no, you had to think of somebody. But
fortunately, he didn't.
What else did you come for?
There was a lot of discussion as far as the Eliza part was concerned, as far as Julie Andrews' participation was concerned, because, interestingly enough, if you remember at the Academy Awards when Rex Harrison accepted the Oscar, he said that he wanted to thank both his fair ladies. One, Audrey Hepburn, who wasn't nominated, and ironically enough, Julie Andrews won that year for Mary Poppins.
Yes, that was a whole interesting thing. Of course, you know, he wasn't known as Sexy Rexy for nothing, so he knew how to keep both ladies happy. And it was of an appropriate remark. I felt so bad that that she did not receive even a nomination,
which
was idiotic of the Academy, in my opinion.
And didn't she present the award to Rex Harrison for Best Actor? Because I forget who it was who was Best Actress the year before wasn't available, and she came in and presented him with his Oscar. And that's when he
was really a good sportsmanship on her part. She was a lovely lady and deserved nomination, probably deserved to win. But with the Marnie Nixon and her group, you know, hitting the press at the time, didn't help Audrey. And there was a great cult thinking Julie should do it. I think their decision was based on the fact that while Julie Andrews may be able to do the first section as a Cockney a little better than Audrey, nobody could be a princess better than Audrey Hepburn. So when they made the switch, that was it. Also, Julie Andrews was not known at the time. She had not worldwide reputation at all, so they just felt from a business standpoint that Audrey would be better.
You're one of the straight sort, Governor.
And it's funny how you have an allegiance to people when you really work with them. So I'm an Audrey Hepburn advocate. Wilfred Hyde White, tremendous for this part. The casting was ideal. And the music, what more could you want from Werner Herzog's music? Proven on the stage and Broadway.
I can't afford them, Governor. Neither could you if you was as poor as me. Not that I mean any harm, mind you, but if Eliza's going to have a bit out of this, why not me, too? Eh? Why not? Well, look at it my way. What am I? I asked you, what am I? I'm one of the undeserving poor, that's what I am. Now, think what that means to a man. It means he's up against middle-class morality for all the time. If there's anything going and I puts in for a bit of it, it's always the same story. You're undeserving, so you can't have it. But my needs is as great as the most deserving widows that ever got money out of six different...
There's a photograph in a frame on one of the walls on the set, which I was told was Gladys Cooper as a young girl in her early part of her acting career in the teens, possibly.
She was a beauty. She was a beauty.
Gladys Cooper, who plays Rex Harrison's mother in the film, yeah.
I'm undeserving.
I think it's the one over in the hallway.
I'm undeserving. I like it, and that's the truth. But will you take advantage of a man's nature to do him out of the price of his own daughter, what he's
timing
brought up,
the three
fed
of them
clothed by the
impeccable
sweat of his brow?
Yes.
Till she's grown.
And if you say Stanley Holloway couldn't hear, I mean, all the more incredible.
It's interesting, the selection of shots that you have to take, whether you stay in a three-shot, whether you cut, move in. It was all covered, but working after with editors, you do it for a rhythm. You get so bored if you just do the cuts back and forth over the shoulder, over the shoulder, over the shoulder. So to play one scene in a three-shot like this is an interesting way to handle it.
When we do a restoration, just as a point of reference, we work very, very hard to try and get the entire frame that you see in the theater onto the video screen. Normally there's quite a bit of corruption in it, and it'll be masked vertically, it'll be masked horizontally.
£10 is a lot of money.
This is the entire frame. As a matter of fact, on video, you're probably seeing a little bit more of the sides than you would on me.
In the theater?
Yes. Very, very slightly.
In the pan and scan versions, you can imagine what those three shots look like.
Oh, well, I do. When I see some of the stuff I've worked on, and I know how carefully we framed the edges and had everything shot,
well, we had
included for composition, and then find that's all altered.
It's gone. Well, we had to do the pan and scan on this. And in some shots, it worked fine. And in others, you just throw up your arms, and no matter what you do, it's not going to be good.
I beg your pardon, miss.
Oh, I'll say this running valve one more time.
There's a Gene Allen bit of business in this one. When we're working with rehearsal with Cukor, he and I, the night before, would always do the scene and walk through it, and he'd have his pages, and we'd do it. So we were doing this, and I reached over and patted an imaginary Audrey on the rear end in the scene. Cukor liked it, and you'll see it here in a moment. Next, there you go. But we'd always do the rehearsal the night before so that we could tell that Harry straddling the next morning and the grips and all, where the first shot would be, kept thing moving that way.
A common dustman, one of the most original moralists in England.
Yes, sir.
Now, was Cecil Beaton on the set? Was he never supervising the costume
crew? He was never on the set. The only time he was on the set, he came in and made Cukor angry when he would try to get Audrey Hepburn to come off to do some stills of her in her costumes. That was the big fight they had early in the thing, but Beaton was never around to have anything to say about any of the sets or any of the camera angles or any of the lighting, none of that, or the editing eventually.
The shot that's on the Laserdisc, and I think is going to be on the DVD, is Cecil Beaton's shot of Audrey in her ascot gown.
Well, he deserves whatever credit he gets for that, because he did do that and the hair and the hats. By the way, when we get to Ascot, remember that those ladies in those big hats created a problem when we would break, and they had to go to the restroom. In the windows, women's restrooms, the doors aren't wide enough for those hats.
On Just You Wait, that was another time that I actually saw the set that they were filming, and they used me only after they used her original track for that, Just You Wait, Dan Riggins, when she's very much of a gutter snipe, and then when she imitates herself, she tries to be a lady, then it becomes me on that song. So there was a switch there in the middle of the song, and then it went back to her toward the very ending when it was her speaking.
We had heard that George Cukor liked the look of the dance at the gym scene from West Side Story. And basically copied that look.
I was around. I never heard that. It just was an outgrowth of Hermes Pan, the set, Audrey.
Well, they kind of vignetted Doopy look. The entire...
Oh, well, let me tell you about that. Cukor loathed that. Cukor hated using that oil. You mean to make it so that you knew that you're in a flashback?
Mm-hmm.
He hated that. He fought with them to get rid of that.
Why did they want that then?
Well, Jack Warner and Rudy Fair felt that that was the way that you tell the audience about flashbacks.
And we're in it
and
right
in
now.
One day you did, but you know, at this age it was certainly not necessary. But see the oil on the edges?
Mm-hmm.
Cukor hated that.
This was a very difficult scene to deal with during the restoration.
I still kid Rudy Fair about their insisting on this, and they won.
Thanks a lot, King, says I, in a manner well bred. But all I want is Henry Higgins.
This is not a motion picture scene to me. This was a Broadway musical scene. For some reason, it never quite worked. But the number was in, and you know, we do it.
Well, sometimes you don't need to show everything. It works in its own strange way, I think. That,
yeah, it's not really distracting, but I just felt it isn't quite the same type of a scene you would do if you didn't have the stage play it was in. You would maybe say that this scene wasn't necessary, Just You Wait, Henry Higgins, but it works.
The video covers a multitude of sins, I can tell you.
Now, that sequence is off of YCM Masters again, and you can see not only one white spot, but two of them when you look at it in 70 millimeter.
A.
I. When we're actually working on these things, we look at the films literally one shot at a time and determine what the problems are with each shot, how we're to fix them. And in our minds, we take the entire film apart. So we're dealing with 1,300 or 1,500 pieces of separate film. We do that figuratively, not literally. One of the problems in 65mm origination is that the splices that hold the different shots together are extremely thin, and they dry out. And as you print them, they tend to occasionally cup.
not to offend
and
his ears.
Splits the center in the printer, which is going 150 feet a minute. It just rips them right down the middle. And My Fair Lady was the negative, was actually cut in a format akin to Technoscope, which is a two-frame format, in which, because you didn't want to see the splice line, you would have an extra frame at the beginning and end of every shot. And that's the way that My Fair Lady was cut. So in taking it apart and putting it back together again, we were actually able to create new splices all through the negative by pulling out these shots and integrating new elements.
Now, repeat that after me.
So we probably removed about 3,000 frames, which were never seen in the finished print.
Now, that frame that we're looking at on this monitor, how does that compare to the big screen at the Academy?
Well, the big screen at the Academy, you see every detail.
It's very rich, and the woods are very beautiful.
It looks like velvet. It looks like you can put your hand into the picture. People were astonished by it because there was no grain, and they're used to seeing all of these new films. And in 1998, we don't have the detail that you and the other people that worked on the film and created it were able to get in 1964.
The only criteria that we use in a restoration is how close can we get to 100%? How close can we get to the day it was released? And I think we've been pretty good at getting at least in the 90s. It's not easy. It's very time-consuming, very labor-intensive. It's dealing with diversified group of people, all of whom in their own area are tops. No matter what, you still never ever can achieve perfection, and we figure at a certain point, when do you stop? And we figure that if we're going to improve the picture 5% by working another month, we'd probably do it, but if it's 1% or 2%, that's probably the time we would stop, where the time does not equate with the percentage of improvement in the picture.
You can never get it 100% anyway today. Even if you have a brand new negative from 1964 that has no fading, it's not going to look like it did in 1964 because the release stops are different. So it handled properly. Perfect negative from 1964 can look appreciably better. It's going to be finer grained, it's going to have richer blacks, richer whites, more gradation in the shadow detail. When we were doing Lawrence of Arabia, we sat down many times with David Lean and Freddie Young, who was the director of photography, and we'd be looking at this wide expanse of desert, and Freddie would be saying, well, I think it was slightly more mauve, and David would say, no, it had a bit more yellow to it. But what they were both seeing was more detail than they saw in 1962.
Freddie's a terrific photographer. We did one film with him, Suwanee Junction, and I got to know him well. Really appreciate his talent.
Well, Freddie is now 95.
Try it again.
That's marvelous.
We speak with him and Joan every couple of months at least. He's an extraordinary man, an extraordinary talent.
Part of this, as you all know, Gene, in understanding what we have to recreate to some extent, is talking to the people on the set.
That young director directed these little bits and pieces.
That Alan?
Yeah, whatever.
Did he change his name to Woody Allen?
No, that's another. That's a distant relative.
We have to get a voice from the set. Unfortunately, now on Rear Window, the only one we have to talk to is the woman who plays Miss Torso. But because she was there and was there every day, we're getting a lot of information and a lot of atmosphere that we normally wouldn't have.
That designer is long gone.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up being head of special effects at MGM after Buddy Gillespie. Macmillan.
Professor Higgins.
On he plots against all odds. Oh, poor Professor Higgins. 9 p.m., 10 p.m., on through midnight every night. 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3, 4, 5, 6
marbles. Now, I want you to read this, and I want you to enunciate every word, just as if the marbles were not in your mouth. with blackest moss the flower pots were thickly crusted, one and all. Each word here is a bell.
With blackest moss the flower pots. I can't.
These restorations also, when they get on video and on DVD, are the definitive records of the film as of today. These references will exist 50 years from now when none of us are around. And that's what we try and leave. We try and leave some record of this, not only a visual record, but an audio record of this.
The production designer could help you very little on 90% of what you guys do, in the sense of, you know, exactly how dark and how light and all, because I think you end up getting a marvelous balance that looks right.
Well, we need color references, and we've gone to extremes.
Oh, a certain thing, yes. Dresses or certain...
Well, we use costumes, but, you know, it's unfortunate that most of the costumes are not available. I think the Covent Garden costume is in the tour at Warner Brothers. The ball gown that she wears, the great shot of her coming down the stairs, was sent to Baltimore for a fundraiser and was in a Ralph's grocery bag and was thrown out. It made it to the event and never made it back. But when we hear that something is in the hands of a collector, we say thank God, because only, you know, within the last 10 years did the studios realize that there was value in keeping these on site. But for a whole period, mostly in the late 60s and 70s and early 80s, these were fair game. All the MGM costumes obviously were sold, and yet those are the only ones that are surviving now.
In many cases, we don't even have a functioning proper reference print to go by. We have to go out to collectors or archives to find a good reference print. And if you find one print, the color may not be right, because you could go, you know, 3 points green, 3 points yellow, 3 points magenta.
And color and memory is very difficult. You know, it's about right is what the best we could say. Did any of you in watching this decide whether Rex is right-handed or left-handed?
Actually, never gave it a whole lot of thought, but there must be a reason why you brought that up.
Well, one, he just took that thing off his head with his left hand, but he played the little xylophone. How nice of you to let me come, or whatever. He played that with his left hand.
The majesty and
so Rex is left-handed. The greatest. Those are important things to know, you see.
Well, it helps in the restoration, certainly.
You see, now, if we found that jacket, that wine-colored jacket would be a great help to us.
You could carry everything from that.
It would give us a reference point. It wouldn't necessarily help us with the backgrounds, but it would give us something to work with. In Vertigo, we used Kim Novak's green dress, and we used the color of the jaguar.
In Rear Window, the only thing that we have are Miss Torso's shorts, and you can only get the color on that by looking inside the cuff on the bottom of it.
But, you know, we did have days and nights, you know, when we get in working later at night. Harry lit this for night, and it looks like the other brighter you could, when you saw those windows, you could see it was bright daylight outside.
Now, try it again.
On the rain in Spain, whenever it was speaking, it was her. The first few lines that are spoken are hers, and then the rest is me. And that, I never worked with her on the acting of that or anything. I just had to remember what she had done in the singing studio, in her vocal lessons, and just record them as I thought she would do them. I'm not sure she was even present at that point. She just had to mouth to my
the
track.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
I think she's got it. I think she's got it.
You know, it's really interesting with the telecine operators. They are so detail-orientated, we really get a lot of misinformation on laser discs and videos and DVDs. I mean, how many times have you seen them walking down a street with a lantern and it's broad daylight? You know, it's only because they were going for detail and not realizing the shot was a day-for-night shot.
Uh-huh.
And we had that in the last scenes of Vertigo, where everyone who saw the film on television thought that the tower should be really light and you should be able to see everything, and in fact Hitchcock left notes saying that it was quite the contrary, that all he wanted to see was it being dark and sparkly.
Now he's using
now to
his
prove
right
that
hand.
I'm wrong, yeah. He's playing with his right hand. Now once
again, for the rain in Spain, I remember just singing to earphones, listening to the whole scene as it had been pre-recorded. Just audio. I wasn't looking at the film already, but just doing a pre-recording of listening to her voice. And then there's a certain spot where then I'm supposed to insert my voice. And I just continued on, and they recorded the singing portions.
You know, there's a perfect example of lighting, color timing, and restoration coming up in the sequence which is coming up after this, when Audrey goes upstairs and the light beside her bed is turned off. If you look at the original negative and you make a properly timed print from that shot, the light is turned off, but the lighting in the room remains the same, and the darkening is actually actuated in the color timing. You're taking the density down in the middle of that shot about 8 or 10 points. But if someone just made an interpositive from the camera negative, it wouldn't get dark in the room.
I know.
We'll take her to the but these are the details.
Yeah,
that
sometimes you
got
shut a lamp
search
off like that when you look through it, and it's lit and it's on, oh, yes, and you look and it distracts from a close-up of her, so you end up shutting something like that off. But your whites are clean, your blacks are black, the woodwork is rich, the greens that were in this set are there.
Well, it was a fully exposed negative, and it was perfectly exposed and perfectly lit. I mean, it... You couldn't ask for a better film element to work with. And fortunately, the problem on this film was not fading. It was tears in the negative and splices opening and lots of dupes and things of that sort. The color was actually quite good. I mean, we could bring it back with very little problem, even though it was stored wretchedly for years. I mean, it couldn't have been in worse storage conditions.
It was stored over the nitrate vaults in Sherman Oaks, the Warner Brothers nitrate vaults. Everything was stored together, soundtrack, negative, everything, a major fire.
It was in blowout vaults, breaking every rule of film archivery and geographic separation. And
a major fire would have destroyed this film forever.
At one point, I had just moved to New York, which I moved back from New York to Los Angeles after that, but I was doing a Broadway show, Girl in Pink Tights, and they were putting together a show called My Fair Lady, and backstage comes a person that everybody else knew. He had been around New York for a long time, and I didn't know, and they said, oh, this is Frederick Loewe. He's coming backstage, and he's going to play us something from his new show. So we, in our show, gathered all around, and we heard a song called I Want to Dance All Night. And it was in three-quarter time. Da-da-da, I want to dance all night. Da-da-da-da, one, two, three, da. Da-da-da-da-da, down, two, three, da-da. And we were all listening to this, and we were saying, oh, it's very nice, but he's a Viennese refugee, you know, and it sounds like operetta, and it's something left over from the old operetta world, and it'll never go on Broadway. And then suddenly, when you hear the show, when you go to the show, you hear, I could have danced all night, but da-da-da, and it's in 4/4 time, which takes away the onus of the dum ba 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 ba. And it sort of changed the whole aspect of it. And that one word, I could have danced all night, rather than I want to, somehow the flow of it and it just completely changed the whole thing. And it was just, of course, the placement in the show. It turned out to be, of course, a very famous number and a wonderful number.
By the way, I'm going to interrupt you here for 1 second. Notice Audrey turns the water on. No one ever turns it off. And as a matter of fact, that faucet is still running at Warner Brothers.
That's what I understand. This little bathroom, I'd like to have built at home.
could have danced.
By the way, she's lovely in these shots Harry did of her. The softness of her face.
It's all been grand.
The light we're talking about is the one that's being turned out now.
Right. Well, his skill is evident throughout the film because he's not only lighting shots like this, he's lighting those shots from the balcony of the library, and he's lighting huge sections of Covent Garden, and they're all beautifully done. By the way, balanced. When you work for Cukor as a cinematographer, we had a rule that there would be no artificial coloring with using any means whatsoever. You shoot what's there.
Well, it shows it. It's beautiful.
No oranges to make things a little day and night type things. Blue filters were not allowed. And also we had another rule is that you eliminate as much color as you can. Film is already colorful. You just shoot a white wall with film. There's color. It fades off into the different colors so that we would always very closely coordinate all the colors that you see. This is what that young director shot, this whole Ascot Gavotte. Well, he's definitely a comer. Yeah. You know why he never went on to become, with all the training he had from Cukor and all? He liked to go down on Saturdays and Sundays and race his dinghy down at Balboa Yacht Club. And you can't be a director and have weekends off. There's no such thing.
You must have run into Herbie Coleman down there, huh?
Yes, the name is familiar, sure.
He was Hitchcock's producer and our link to the past on all of those films that we've done. Faces, Gene, all came from...
They're all dancers.
So they were singing to playback?
Yes. That redhead I feature quite a bit as the director. You'll see her in this. You'll see her earlier in scenes. And well, she really had a terrific look and style.
Well, there were some very Vogue-looking faces in there.
Now, whether Beaton had anything to do with it when they were doing hair and hats or anything, I have no idea on that part of it. Hermes Pan and Cukor would normally pick the people.
And they actually ran these horses down the stage.
Interesting story. Thoroughbred horse racers in a stage. How do you get them up to full speed and out the door? Well, you couldn't. So we went to slim-looking quarter horses. Then the stage door was open off to our left here. And as they ran out across that street, you run right into the Warner Brothers commissary. That was the stage we had. So we had to put up a black tarp and paint racetrack rails on the tarp so that as they came out the door, they would see them and start turning to go away from the rails, which were painted.
So you weren't designing just for the film. You were designing to get the horses off the set.
Yeah, but I was just thinking... The care that we went to and to do all of that and get it to working, and that was part of my second unit. Today, with computers, would we have even bothered?
No, you wouldn't have.
Not at all. We would have got some good racetrack horses running and put them in there.
But you wouldn't have gotten the sharpness because the digital materials that are used today are done at such low resolution that they're actually...
All of this, these are the big hats where the restroom was a problem.
And you notice they're black and white.
And they're terrific. And look at the blacks. That's black.
Well, this is what we went for. This
is an old W.C. Fields actor, Grady Sutton. Do you guys get this joke?
Of course.
Okay. I didn't know. All of these are little bypass, little things that happen.
That is a great face.
Isn't that terrific? That's a Cukor selection. And now he's...
He bumbles into her.
Now Cukor's got this I let him carry on.
Was he a good assistant?
He worked. He seemed to pick it up pretty well.
Mother?
Henry, what a disagreeable surprise.
Hello, Mother. How nice you look.
What are you doing here? You promised never to come to Ascot. Go home at once.
I can't, Mother. I'm here on business.
Oh, no, Henry, you mustn't. I'm quite serious. You offend all my friends. The moment they meet you, I've never seen them again. So you're not even dressed for Ascot.
I changed my shirt. Now, listen, Mother, I got a job for you, a phonetics job. I picked up a girl.
Henry.
Oh, no, not a love affair. She's a flower girl. I'm taking her to the annual embassy ball, but I want you to try her out first.
I beg your pardon?
Well, you know the embassy ball.
Of course I know the ball, but...
So I invited her to your box today. Do you understand?
Common flower girl?
Oh, she'll be all right. I've taught her how to speak properly. She has strict instructions as to her behavior. She's to keep to two subjects, the weather and everybody's health. Fine day, and how do you do? And not just let herself go on things in general. Help her along, darling. You'll be quite safe.
Safe to talk about one's health in the middle of a race.
Well, she's got to talk about something.
You know, this is the one place where we did do surrounds, split surrounds, as the horses, you hear the horses come in on the right side as they cross the screen. They're in the center speaker, and then they go off to the left.
Mrs. Einsford here.
One of the interesting things when you're planning a restoration, this film was recorded in six-track discrete stereo, which means that you had one track for surround and then five tracks behind the screen, left, center, center, right, center, and right, with totally discrete information coming from each channel. Going into the 70s and the 80s, the design in theaters was to eliminate discrete information on channels 2 and 4 and have only what are called baby booms, subwoofers in those channels, which were used for a lot of the effects films and things of that sort. And in 1994, when we restored this, still the majority of the theaters did not have discrete information. Right. We didn't have the ability to run it in five discrete channels. So we had to remix it. It's preserved in full six-track, but the prints were created with full spectrum of sound and only left, center, and right. And then basically phantom channels in 2 and 4 and the baby booms. But what's happening now is that with the proliferation of SDDS from Sony, there are three wonderful systems out there. You have Dolby Digital, SDDS, and DTS, which we use on Vertigo. DTS 70 is a great system. Two things have now come together at the same time, which is really superb for us. Because with SDDS, theaters have again, on the larger screens, put back full-spectrum speakers in positions 2 and 4. And with DTS 70, we can now use those speakers and get all five channels behind the screen with just replugging in the theaters. So technology has rather come full circle.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain. But in Hartford, Hereford...
This is obviously the dress in the picture that everybody remembers. Yeah, this is one we've tried to track for years.
And, well, you've got it, because there was just black and white and that little touch of red.
Red. Well, the red comes out on Eastman color stock. Incredibly.
But in this scene, you capture the lightness, the whiteness of her thing through the grays of the guy's suits to the black.
Well, then we also had that brown suit lurking in the background.
Right.
And, so, you know, you can't go too far either way without affecting that.
In the early Laserdisc incarnations of this film, everything was beige. I mean, literally.
I remember.
Cream, cream color, yeah.
There was no white, there was no black.
Every production of My Fair Lady had that dress in it. It was copied in one way or another. We would find copies all over the place, but no one ever really was able to find the one that had the studio label in it, you know, that says Audrey Hepburn, My Fair Lady, Warner Brothers.
Gene, do you know if there were multiples of these dresses, or did they just make one?
Depending on the cost of it, they may take a chance with Audrey Hepburn wearing it as easily as she does, not needing a second one. But on the other hand, I can't see that they wouldn't have a backup because of what it would cost if something went wrong in the middle of it.
Which would have meant that two would have disappeared, or three would have
disappeared. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
These close-ups, again, are unbelievable.
Yeah,
the color, the definition.
I heard the glow from inside the skin coming out instead of the pancake look.
This is a film that really demands to be seen in 70 millimeter on a big screen. Seeing it on video, no matter how good the process, is rather like reading a paperback book of a great illustrated hardcover.
Well, it was one of the few films that really combined, as you said before, Gene, the reality and a stylized scene like this, and married the two to a point where they worked to perfection.
Yeah, you really had to be careful on how much you adhered to the stage play and how much you added to this. Something about this, when you see all that beautiful lattice work, and it was some of it in trompe l'oeil, where you really had three-dimension look into a flat plane. One day I came on the stage, and there was a bulldozer, and they bulldozed that set.
The trompe l'oeil wall?
The whole, all of this, everything. It was all up, and they just had the bulldozer start at one end. And unfortunately, the reason they do that is once they get the director say, yeah, that I, they want to get rid of the set so he can't have a retake. It's a money-saving device. Sometimes they say that it's because they need the stage, but the stage stayed empty.
We're coming up on the other digital shots here. There are four digital scenes. For whatever reason, the original negative was damaged on some of the cutaways to
Well, you know, we shot this
group.
Oh, this one. This is one that...
No, that scene is digital, and you can see there's a softening of it. You'll see four of them. That's digital.
That has a kind of a, like a glass in front of it.
And here we're also seeing our surrounds go around.
That one is digital. One of them of Rex was digital. The problem, the negative had already been damaged in 1964 by the time the black and white separation masters were created. All of the damage was in those seps, so they had to be each one cleaned digitally, input a 65 millimeter dupe negative, computer generated, computer cleaned, and taken down to this division, output on 35 millimeter 8 perf, and then optically enlarged again back to 65 millimeter.
Today they can output to 65, which would help us a bit at that time.
Give it up? Why, it's the most fascinating venture I've ever undertaken. Pickering and I are at it from morning till night. It fills our whole lives. Teaching Eliza, talking to Eliza, listening to Eliza, dressing Eliza.
What? You're a pretty pair of babies playing with your live doll. Here's the car.
I'd love to have that car to go to the Academy Awards.
Any idea what that car is?
No.
We never see the front of it.
That whole set was sort of improvised after we had the regular sets up, and then Cukor wanted some sort of an exit. So we just kind of built that with existing sets.
Was Jeremy Brett really known at this point, or was he just...
Not too much known, but he was brought over to be the singer, and of course then they doubled his voice.
Mm-hmm.
That's on that piece of material that you guys have after the... when we're talking about the film when he talks.
Mm-hmm.
He was on the other night on television.
On the AMC show, yeah.
Yeah.
And toward the end of his career, I guess he became known as the consummate Sherlock Holmes.
I asked Harry if we could do a lot of this in telephoto. It gave us kind of an interesting effect when you see the number itself.
Well, you have foreground out of focus.
Yeah.
Things of that sort.
We're miles away from the actors, mm-hmm. You know, way down at the end of the stage.
That was the photograph of Gladys Cooper, I think, that we just passed. But the interesting thing here, this doesn't look like a set. This looks like a real building, and that's the artistry of it.
What it is when I took an actual building in London, I kept the same height and reduced everything by half in width. So it's taller. Those windows and things that you see are reduced in width, and it gave it kind of a nice look.
When she told about her father,
But it's still with the railings and the whites again and the blacks and grays. It has that sort of lacy look that seems to...
Well, it never looked, any, never looked any better than this for the first print that was in the theater.
Yes,
well,
that's good to hear.
Whom shall I say is called?
Keep us fighting the good fight.
If she doesn't remember who I am, tell her I'm the chap who was sniggering at her.
Yes, sir.
And will you give her these?
Yes, sir. Wouldn't you like to come in, sir? They're having dinner, but you may wait in the hall.
But I think people with money don't care about the artistic arguments. I think they listen and sort of nod. But it really comes down to dollars and pennies. These are these televoto shots where we're really a long way away from
it. When you see a film like this on a huge screen, it doesn't come down to entertainment or simply entertainment or simply artistry. There's really a visceral element that becomes part of it. I mean, the other night at the Academy, there were people sitting there with their jaws open.
Well, the interesting thing on these restorations and on the screenings that we have, we're dealing with people who saw it when it first came out, and then there's a whole middle generation in there who only know these films from television or from video or what have you. And then there's this really great audience that doesn't know how it's going to end. And it's all new to them. It's all an exciting discovery. And if we can just convey this to the powers that be, they will, I think, understand what we're saying and how their grandchildren and great-grandchildren should have this experience and be able to see these not just in home viewing situations, but be able to go and see them as they were meant to be seen on the big screen.
It's a wonderful detail there. I mean,
there is a lot
actually of... actually have a gas lamp being lit in the background.
But all of these buildings were built so they could be transported to the exterior, to the back lot.
Mm-hmm.
And they were... Cukor loved the telephoto effect. He hates extras or people in backgrounds and things normally, but he loves how soft and out of focusing it, you saw the action of the individual.
Did he go to dailies?
No. He sent me to all the dailies. But then he would sit down with John and gave him a list after list. The editor tells a story on the laser disc about that, of how Cukor said, do this, do that, do this, do that. And John never took shorthand, so he was writing. And so John said, one time Gene Allen said, for goodness sake, slow down. He can't take shorthand.
Would Jack Warner go to dinner?
Yes, they would on their own. They would go to different areas. And they would talk to the editor, Ziegler, without Cukor being there. And they would tell him what they wanted. And that became a bone of contention as time went on.
It's interesting, the number of well-known directors who never went to dailies. Hitchcock never went to dailies.
Cukor would rather see them in a showing of two or three reels, two, three, four, five, or something. So there was some continuity to his remarks. That number that he sings...
on the street where you live?
Lerner said to me, are you ashamed of my number? He says, I'm not used to having my numbers ending with fun in the back of a singer. But we did that to carry the story along as he came up and he finished the song.
The lights come down,
and you're back on the house and you go in the house to have a clean cut, end of the song, then cut into the interior. There's no flow. So, but it was interesting that he picked that up. Saying,
well, we had real changes to deal with music over them, which are nightmares. We'd be changing reels over music.
Could force me to recant. Perhaps you'd excuse me. Do you understand, Higgins? It's over, Higgins. Higgins, if there's any mishap at the embassy tonight, if Miss Doolittle suffers any embarrassment whatever, it'll be on your head alone.
Eliza can do anything.
Suppose she's discovered. Remember Ascot. Suppose she makes another ghastly mistake.
There'll be no horses at the ball, Pickering.
Think how agonizing it would be. Oh, if anything happened tonight, I don't know what I'd do.
Was Jack Warner really hands-on as a producer on this picture?
Yes, he was, because he was had hands-off. Ideal producers put all the people together, then stay back and let Cukor take over. And Warner did that. He only came down on the set once, that I recall. I got a picture of Jack Warner and I. They were taking all these quick snaps. And Jack Warner leaned over and said, kid, if you want yours selected out of that table of photographs tonight, point. And so I always now point, but I've got a picture of Jack Warner and I. He's pointing and I'm pointing.
Well, the color of the port is perfect.
This was a wonderful transition, too, going from, you know,
absolutely,
going from the dinner table to the day. He said he's through, I'm finished. The next thing we see is the night of the ball. I think it was great.
When we do a restoration, if there is not a good preservation element, the first thing we do is make one. In this case, a 65-millimeter interpositive that CBS allowed us to make, which is about another $55,000 to $60,000. Lest something might tear, we'd have something other than the black and white separations, which might not work to go back to, or certainly wouldn't have the quality of the original. Well, when we were printing this, that's the shop that decided to tear in the middle of the restoration. And this one shot is off that emergency interpositive.
And these are things that we do as a matter of course. A lot of the people doing this at the studios...
Now we're back in the original.
They will save the $60,000.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
But can you imagine if that one shot had to be off of a bad dupe that didn't register or didn't focus?
Yeah, because it's a key story point.
And that's the one that literally tore.
So little, you look beautiful.
Thank you, Colonel Pickering.
Don't you think so, Higgins? Not bad. Not bad at all.
I always thought that her hairdo was too severe. If I was directing this picture, I would have argued a little more about her look. It looks like a shellac job.
But yeah, you know, it's really interesting.
Almost a Roman helmet.
It's interesting here, though, that the hair is over the top, but the dress is very simple and very conservative.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And it's a lot of...
Terrific. I like the dress very much.
And a lot of Audrey.
This. And that was a nice point. I'm sure that was in the stage play where he has to come back and offer his arm.
It's like the first bit of humanity.
Yeah.
It's also interesting how many of the costumes and even the jewelry in that shot were around her neck, how she liked to have things high.
Oh, she had to, because she has a real long neck. Mm. She is like a crane.
My experience with My Fair Lady has been absolutely life-changing. Not only the film, but the project, the musical itself. I've done the role many, many times myself since My Fair Lady. And, of course, I felt very well informed because I was able to work with a wonderful actress and to observe her process of putting the character into her voice and of playing My Fair Lady. The movie, I think, is part of our national treasure, as is a lot of the movies of those eras. I don't know that that will ever come back, and I am so happy that everything is being preserved and even upgraded. The sound is evidently pristine. We're able to save these things for posterity. And I feel the perspective that I have now looking back at it and realizing what is meant to me for the rest of my life, and the future generations are just rediscovering the movie for the first time. I feel happy that now I'm able to get the credit. I don't really know when that changed, but the fact that I wasn't given credit during the movie times doesn't matter anymore. I've gotten a lot out of getting the credit now. It's been a it's been a life-changing thing for me. It's changed the focus of my career.
In this scene, before they go into the next room, there's a marvelous old actor that played in all of Cukor's pictures, from MGM on.
Is that Henry Danielle?
He goes in the door with Audrey.
I'm your pupil.
He escorts the queen or whoever she is, and dies that night. And we come in the next morning to pick up the scenes, and that's my job, is where are we going to shoot? And how do we fake the
he
next
literally
without him?
Passed
yeah, he
away?
Died. Yeah, he died away.
This is Henry Danielle?
Henry Danielle died the night scene at the end of this, before they go in the next room. marvelous actor. You'll see him over the years in all the great classics of the MGM
great
movies.
Great character actor.
But the next morning, I was in there trying to work with Harry to how can we make believe he's still there when he's not. So we went ahead and did it, and it works fine. Nobody noticed.
Greek, my foot. He pretends not to know any English, but he cannot deceive me. He's the son of
a... He has such a unique face.
He speaks English so villainously that he cannot utter a word without betraying his origin. I help him pretend, but I make him pay through the nose. I make them all pay.
Excuse me, sir, you are wanted upstairs. Her Excellency asked you.
Excuse me.
That little bit Harrison does of clicking his heels. What's my name? Nice bit of business. This is her second entrance, isn't it, with this dress?
Yeah, the, in the house.
Coming down the stairs and then another entrance here. Right.
The interesting thing, when you've got a good audience and you're running this thing in really good projection and a nice print, she makes an entrance to the applaud. It's like it's the stage play.
It was interesting at the screening that we had to see kids watching it. They really enjoy it, really identify with it, and...
That amazes me. I teach a couple of courses at UCLA Extension, and we have a lot of young people. I teach in production design. They all know this movie, and they're of an age where they shouldn't.
Mr. and Mrs. Richard Lanza.
I think somebody mentioned here, you know, that it was a whole different generation.
Well, Disney figures every 7 years there's a new generation to see a film, and they should know.
Colonel Pickering, Professor Higgins.
Your Excellency.
There's Harry is right there on the left now. This is his last day on this earth.
Good evening,
Colonel. Oh, Colonel. Ah. What an enchanting young lady you have with you,
Thank you.
Well, who is she?
Oh, a cousin of mine.
That's Henry Danielle on the left.
On the left, yeah.
Professor Higgins.
And, you know, you sit, I sit and wonder, what's he feeling like? Is he ill? You know, the poor guy.
He died that night.
That night.
Apparently, there was a short documentary done on the stage that was set up for makeup and costumes at the studio, that they had about 50 makeup booths and costume areas on sound stages, and then there was a little bus that would take them from...
It was a tram.
Yeah, from that sound stage over to the set.
What we actually did was knock a hole inside of the stage, so that they could all come in rather than going through the big main doors. And they could exit, and it was closer to the ladies' room where they had the problem with the hats. In that one bunch, they had to cut out openings on 2x4s to let them through.
Incredible number of people to dress for the scene like this.
Does he really come from Yorkshire?
George Cooper was just around to give some advice occasionally for the songs, but he really wasn't around for me. He was around for Audrey. And so I think George Cooper worked mainly through Audrey, and what I always took it from was after Audrey had worked with George Cooper, she would then come and sing the songs in her sessions and sing them for me, and we would sing them together. So I was always taking my interpretation from Audrey, which was, you know, a part of George Cooper's direction, but I never really worked with him a lot.
And from what we found out, this was the woman who plays the Queen of Transylvania was a Rothschild.
She's a Rothschild, and she lives down in Mandeville Canyon. That's her right there.
Charming, quite charming.
Cukor had many friends like that that he would bring in for these parts.
In the scene where she asks her to dance with her son, there's a lot of very tentative ADR there, which we didn't know whether or not...
You know Frank Gifford, the
football
announcer
player?
And the football player?
Sure.
He was asked to try out for that part. And
of the son?
For the son to dance with Audrey, and he wasn't graceful enough.
which is a true story, Frank. I'm sorry, but that's the story I heard.
One of the nice things in working with 65 millimeter is that you're working in either what's called auto select, which is a form of printing, or A and B rolls, and all of the dissolves and all of the fades are from original material, as opposed to having them cut in and duped. And a lot of the older 35 millimeter features before duping materials were that good, you can actually see a degradation of the image as you'll drop two generations at the frame just before a dissolve will cut in, and then it comes back up right afterwards. But here, where we have a dissolve, it's all original. The dissolve can be absolutely perfect, and each side can be timed out or color corrected perfectly also.
At this stage in the shooting, they realized that we carried on the schedule the way they had it laid out originally, was that we would put Audrey into overtime, and it was big, big money. So this set was designed and built in very few days and moved up on the schedule so that it would help get her out in time, which I think they did. That's interesting what you can pick out that you know that say we would never know. But when you mention it, you
can see it's the color
screen sort
off.
Of something went in between you and the film.
Well, when you work on something for 2 years, it becomes an old friend.
Yeah. There's my friend Grady Sutton again, and we put a mustache on him so you wouldn't recognize him from the mascot.
One of the interesting things about this film, that it really is timeless. The audiences are as they were 35 years ago.
I think there's a scale to it that the normal motion picture scale, there's a feeling of space.
Grandeur.
Yes.
And probably one of the best scores ever written for a musical.
I certainly think so, in the sense of what you mentioned about him having to follow Shaw's words, how well that was done. And I like some of the themes. Why can't a woman be more like a man?
That got a big laugh the other day. That always gets a laugh at screenings.
No, yeah, but in this day and age, only Rex Harrison could get away with that. Men are so gentle. Would you care if I went out with another guy? Worked well, the kind of a whispering scene taken through the whole line. Here we thought that Harrison was only teaching her to speak, but he taught her to dance when we weren't watching.
It was also amusing to hear the audience speaking after each song, sometimes not realizing that that particular song came from My Fair Lady. When he sang, I've grown accustomed to her face, and the ones that are more popular, I think that some of the younger people were surprised that this is where it originated.
The color here, the scheme of the colors, the inside of his cape, her cape.
Yeah, and it's all related, and it's all relation to the greens.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically a gray-green room. But you don't put blue books in when you want to do that scene. So you have to be ever vigilant that the prop man doesn't come in and put books in that you don't want, or somebody slips in a film.
How many films are there, Gene, that really get that much attention to detail?
I would think minimal, although everybody that I know that's a production designer on the shows would like to control it to the extent that I was able to on this, but there isn't the relationship that I had with QCOR between most shooting pictures. They're a new team. They only work one picture with a director. There's not that relationship.
It's like Hitchcock and Henry Bunster.
Right, or Bob Boyle.
And John Box, where they just stay together. I guess they appreciate each other's profession.
But you're all talking about directors with great eyes. Today, a lot of the directors might be able to do action, and they may have other skills, but there are a few directors who have the eye that these guys had and who do pay attention to the sets. And
this is really a great primer for anyone interested in production design or set decoration.
It is. It's, you know, it's of a piece, which is something QCOR always talked about. With a heavy, heavy hand on the right, right note. Sort of QCOR expression.
I said to him, you did it, you did it, you did it. They thought she was ecstatic and so damned aristocratic, and they never knew that you did it.
Thank goodness for Zoltan Kapathy. If it hadn't been for him, I'd have died of boredom.
Kapathy, that dreadful Hungarian, was he there?
Yes, he was there all right, and up to his old tricks.
There's nothing there that really seems out of place. And the sets look lived in.
And yet, clean, with the staff of people they had.
To find out who this Miss Doolittle.
That's something QCOR insisted on, is that we always had the... Before you ever got there and ready to shoot, everything was clean and polished and dust, because, you know, that the dust that falls down on the stage from those lamps and the guys walking around and all that.
Well, you're
really
dealing
a thorough cleaning job every day.
You're dealing with a Super Panavision 70 camera, which the film is 65 millimeter wide, and that's going to pick up anything.
It does.
Between that and the Panavision lenses.
Oozing charm from every pore, he oiled his way around.
The resolution that was captured on this film.
He could play, he used.
We had another rule straddling went along with it. Most of the times, cameramen, if they get a little flare on a dark wood or something, they go in and they have their standby painter kill it. By the time you shot a couple of days, you got all of these brown marks all over sets. We never did that. Harry would be given the time to relight it or to change the lighting, to move the camera a little bit. So, there's a thousand details there that make for
a
good-looking picture.
Whereas others are instructed in their native language, English people aren't.
I guess we come back to the difference between art and business.
She may have studied with an expert,
things like that painting over the queen was not just a prop that was brought in. I took it and had the scenic painters who has the jurisdiction paint that painting. We found some research and had him paint it for the film. It's over the fireplace.
Hungarian, but of royal blood. She is a princess. Her blood, he said, is bluer than the Danube is or ever was. Royalty is absolutely written on her face. She thought that I was taken in, but actually I never was.
Who was it who said that you were the member of her race? Ultimate conquest of business? They said that we epitomize the conflict between art and business in the industry.
Well, you do, leaning towards art, which is the way it should be.
But we're very conscious.
You probably could have spent $2 million on this, but you didn't.
Well, there was no need.
No, I don't think we spend more than we have to, but I think that we don't spend less than we have to.
But we do it because we love the films. We do it because we want to see them survive. But in another way, it enables us to give things back to the people that created them in the first place. And I certainly don't say this in a patronizing way. But, well, I mean, we have a little respect for you, Gene.
A little.
Not a lot, you know, a little.
But I think
nobody asked me how we made that stairway so solid. There's no
support. How did you make
support?
That stairway so solid?
There's no support. It's a circular stairway.
We can say one.
We can't say we did it without a nail. But
good night, Higgins.
I think I'll turn in too. Good night, Higgins. Been a great occasion.
Good night, Pickering.
Audrey Hepburn, to me, was she was a thinker.
I meant to ask her to give me coffee.
She was not a spontaneous person like I always think of. Julie Andrews is just sort of, she just comes out with things. Audrey Hepburn, you had the feeling that she would always sift them through and think through to make sure that it was the proper thing to say. Very aristocratic. Maybe she was spontaneous in her own way, but I never took her that way. It was always kind. It was never a put down. And I remember once the limousine that picked us up in the morning at certain times, she would be in the limousine, which I thought was unusual because usually you have your own private limousine. But for some reason, at sometimes she was there, maybe to give us more time to be together. And she would talk privately about the birth of her first son and how she, being so small, had had this 10-pound baby, and it was so huge, and she wanted to have a natural childbirth, and what a hard time that was. And I was just absolutely impressed that she was saying something so personal as that to me. And then she would say things to me like, "Oh, Marnie, I don't think anybody would ever treat you badly, would they? Because you're such a nice person." I mean, she always put you at ease. She was lovely. And in our working sessions, she was very open to give herself to make sure that I would take from her all of her acting intent. And she could tell that I was observing that and that I had no ego to try to counteract that or insert what I wanted to do. It was always I wanted to do what she wanted to do, and to imagine just how her voice would do it if she could sing it better. And it was interesting also, years later, I was present at an interview and her son was there after she had died, and her son told me that every night after during the rehearsals of My Fair Lady, she would come home and would be so discouraged because, first of all, she knew that she was not making it vocally as much as she wanted to, that she was not quite good enough. She could hear, but she was also always talking about how much she admired me and how talented I was to be able to carry on her voice like that and to insert my voice and make it sound like hers. You know, so she was cool. Very, you know, I thought it was amazing. In the end, when they told her that Wouldn't It Be Lovely, for instance, would have to be redone with my voice totally, and some other parts that had to be redone vocally were going to be used. So in the end, most of the show would be with my voice in it. She walked out of the studio, evidently said nothing. She came back the next day and apologized to everybody for her wicked behavior. Which, of course, in our terms, wasn't wicked at all. But the fact that she had walked out, I mean, it's not something that Audrey would ever do. She was a very strong person, and she apologized for that. So she accepted it, and I thought that was a wonderful thing.
I'm sure you won't have any difficulty in settling yourself somewhere or other.
You know, the digital companies don't like particularly to work with us because they're high maintenance and we don't have a lot of money. They would really like to continue doing deep impact and Independence Day and Air Force One and films like that.
Not now, of course, when you've been crying.
The problem that we have is that if you go to digital on a shot, it's not going to match the shots on either side. If you do a digital shot in a new feature film, and you have filled with digital shots, there's nothing to compare it against. But here, if you go digital on one shot, and we used high resolution on this one. On normal films, we just did one on Rear Window. It's one scene, and I think the shot is 14 feet long. We had no negative. We had no separation. It's nothing. And it had to come off a dupe, and I think that one shot was something like $7,000 or $8,000.
And also, weren't they putting out 5K or so on the, you know, at this point?
Maybe four.
They were doing 4 or 5K at Cinesite. And then,
which was doubled because of the VistaVision.
And now, the most you can get out of the digital houses is only 2.8. And they're calling it 3, but it's really not a true 3. which is not really film resolution.
Animation, you can get away with a lot of it. But if you don't have the subtle
gradations. Is the result of the digital, is that what you're talking about? There's like that slight variation.
Now, there was only one shot here that was digital.
That was her face.
Well, the problem on this particular reel, you're looking at reel 9B at the moment. This is all off of Separation Masters.
Why'd you bother about that in the middle of the night?
I want to know what I may take away with me. I don't want to be accused of stealing.
In this case, we actually, since we were able to recut the camera negative, we used it to make a couple of prints and then to make an interpositive from which we made a dupe negative. But when we go back in and we replace old dupes or we make corrections, we worked two ways in this film. Because the original negative is acetate and the restoration negative is polyester, so it won't tear. Although some laboratories have been able to tear it. We actually go back, and for this reel, we'll go back to the black and white separations, do one reel in acetate, which we will conform to the original camera negative. And then most people would go out and make an interpositive from that and a dupe negative, which costs you about an eighth of the cost. What we do is go back to the separations one more time, make another dupe negative from those separations, this time in polyester. So every time we went back to this film and either replaced damaged footage or did digital or anything else, we always did it twice. So that the original negative has original negative, but we're not losing two generations further. We're not going two generations more in cutting it into the restoration negative. They're both of the same quality. And I don't know anyone else that does that.
Well, you know, when you're doing these restorations, the most important aspect of them is conceptualizing the restoration. It's doing the work is one thing. But you have to find the right way to go about doing this. And we've had enough experience now, especially with large format, to have experienced all possible methods. And we know now what will work and what won't work. And yet there's a lot of work being done at studios now where they are not familiar with the technology or the methods photochemically available to them. Through trial and error, do more damage to the elements than they do help them.
You really have to understand, you have to go in and do research, which in our case will take several months, and it continues while we're actually working on the restoration. But you want to find, if you can, the original continuity reports, the daily continuity reports, the daily camera reports.
Camera reports are very important, and if the continuity person is around, they're tremendously helpful to us.
But you want to know how the film was made to find out how you can take it apart, and that tells you then how you can put it back together again. We're basically taking the film, taking it apart, putting it back together, and putting it through post-production again.
And the interesting thing is this raises another whole side to film restoration, and that's the ethics of film restoration. And things that are being done in just a passing way are really violations of the artist's rights.
Well, should an executive at a film company, for example, who may be there for, be it 18 months or 3 years or whatever, and then will go on to a better job with more money somewhere else, should they be in a position in which they're dictating how an important film is restored, how much money can go into it? Because ultimately, you're better off not restoring it.
But it's more reconstruction, because when you're restoring it is one thing, but if you decide to reconstruct the film in a way that the director did not intend it to be, this is a violation.
Well, or just changing it.
Or changing it in any way arbitrarily to make it more appealing from a marketing standpoint, as is the case in several films that will be coming out shortly. These are really questions that people should step back and address.
Governors of the early states had the right to fiddle around with the Constitution because it was in their possession for a while. Did they have that right or not, or for the long run, like it is, it should remain as it was. Well, this is not as historical a piece, but important movies are that important to me. They're a national treasure, and they belong in a national archive, and they should be preserved as would any national treasure, notwithstanding profits and losses or the whims and egos of studio executives.
Well, but the cost of properly restoring a film is such a pittance. Well, first of all, one has to differentiate between preservation and restoration, and then restoration and reconstruction. To preserve a black and white film costs $6,000 to $8,000. Not a major amount. To restore a black and white film can cost $50,000 to $100,000. To preserve a color film properly can cost $30,000. To restore a color film in 35 millimeter can cost $400,000 to $500,000. And in 65 millimeter, which is known as 70 because of the extra without board of the perforations for magnetic, final product is 70. You're looking at anywhere from $850,000 to $1.5 million or $2 million if you have to reconstruct it or take parts of films from prints and readapt color and things of that sort. I mean, My Fair Lady cost right around, what, about $1.2 million, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Which was money that CBS put out gladly.
And what length of time? Was it 9 months, 8 months?
This My Fair Lady took almost 2 years to restore.
2 years. Yeah. Well, again, that shows how cheap.
I know there was a lot of Show Me that she wanted to insert her own voice into. The master track contained me and her. They finally then threw out all of her portions, and she then tried to re-record some of my portions, but in the end it was all me.
How do you like my little water down that street?
That's a nice wonderful touch.
Her husband liked that when we had the wrap party. He came over and he said, I really like that water in the alley.
Don't talk a fool, don't talk at all. Show me.
There's a film coming out shortly, a classic, that has sequences in the film that the director never intended to be in there. It's becoming a marketing venture, not a reconstruction or preservation or restoration venture. And these are things that all of the souls who are coming out in favor of artist rights should address. And we're waiting to see if that in fact happens.
Is he still alive, the director?
No. Same director of another film from the same year that's been misrestored this year.
Eliza, where are you going?
To the river.
What for?
To make a hole in it.
This is one scene where the negative is very, very thin on the right side there. You can see there just has no guts to it at all.
No, that's the way it was. It was just nothing there.
Taxi!
Taxi! But I've no money.
I have.
Where do we go?
Where I belong!
Something I don't like that I see on television all the time now is where they're taken. Suddenly Fred Astaire appears in a commercial doing a with a vacuum cleaner, and they turn it into a commercial. And on one hand, it's funny, but it isn't funny. You know, I kind of watch it. And I think, yeah, that's clever, but is that really good?
But the interesting thing is, it's a double-edged sword because you know you ask a lot of people who that is dancing, and they don't know
it's Fred Astaire. Yeah, well, and, you know...
It's, in one sense, keeping his...
The commercial aspect will always win out, but I'm just wondering from the artistic rights, and I shouldn't talk about that because I was part of colorization.
Are you colorized?
I'm colorized. I'm really black and white.
Well, it's a very good job, Gene.
There was a wonderful shot there before with the sort of peach-colored dress and the violets in the front. There are combinations, color combinations that are really wonderful in this picture.
You know, and again, great care to do that. It isn't easy. Mm-hmm. You've got guys buying the lettuce and you got, you know, people bringing everything in. And if you're not observant and a watchdog over it, you won't have this kind of an effect. Nothing pops out. Nothing's wrong.
Everything is perfect.
But if you lay out the blue from her hat and the peach dress and the violets, they're really colors that would normally clash, and here you see how beautifully they're orchestrated with the green in the background. And this happens throughout the entire film.
And then Harry's lighting is superb.
Well, it's one of the most beautifully designed films, I think, in film history.
Good morning, miss. Can I help you?
Mind if I warm my hands?
And it's just an incredible
right
watch on a big screen. The only problem being that when you're shooting something again in Super Panavision 70, and you have people going out and buying the lettuce, if you've got a little caterpillar walking out with a lettuce, that lens is going to pick it up.
Excuse me, ma'am.
Well, that's an
early
treat,
morning
that's
light fixes my eyes. Can I get you a taxi, ma'am? A lady like you shouldn't be walking alone round London this hour in the morning.
No, thank you.
Idea of the scale. See that lady sitting on those columns?
Yeah, when the fellow walking behind, it's...
With my assistant, we were laying this out, and he kept saying, well, this is the actual size. I said, make it a little bigger.
Do come again.
I did that like three times on everything.
Oh, thank you, Michael Byrne, thank you. Here, come here. Take the missus a trip to Brighton with my compliment book. Thank you, Mr.
Now, we hit bad separation masters in this film. They're very, very contrasting. And there's one scene that you'll see in a moment of Stanley Holloway that had a tear going through three or four frames. And the shot is so long, it would have used up virtually the entire budget of the restoration
to digitize
it and then bring it back. So what we did was to go to the separations, and we had no way around it, and the shot just gets really contrasty. Although you can play with it a bit on video. I don't know if you'll be able to see it on here, but you'll probably be able to see the contrast.
When you go to the
shadow detail will diminish.
When you go from this shot to this reverse, it gets softer on the reverse.
It does. Well, there's some filtration on those. Moral reform societies. And not on Stanley.
The most original moralist in England was Mr. Alfred P. Doolittle, a common Dutchman.
See here?
I would have thought that it was because she was lit differently than he was.
It could be, sure.
Or maybe there were a few wrinkles that they...
Well, her lighting was much softer, and his is pretty much dead on.
Jack Warner came to me and said, Gene, I have promised that we'll do a pub crawl in England. And I promised Rex Harrison that we'd do Damn, I've Grown Accustomed to a Face in England. He says, can you do something to help me out? So I said, all I can do is try. So I put together this sequence, threw it up for Cukor, who bought it, the pub crawl. And I did just two or three pubs, but I put fake facades and one thing in front of the other. One is pink, one is yellow, one is some other color. And then as we shot the thing, we'd take it off. And then there'd be another bar behind it, and it had a different look. Then we'd take the extras outside in their costumes and have the standby painter spray, would protect their face, and we'd spray the costume to give it a different color to go with that next pub scene. So all the way through, it kind of flows. You can't see it anywhere. But anyway, they bought the pub crawl. That saved Warner, I would think, $1 million to not have to take it and cut me over there and shoot it over there. The other one was Damn, and that was a revamp of Covent Garden. And Harrison said he wouldn't agree until he saw what it is we had in mind. So I revamped overnight Covent Garden, made a street that he walks on later on here, you'll see. And Rex came in, chased it off, said, okay. Well, that saved Warner's another batch of money by doing it on here. And it worked as fine. I think it looks as good or better than if he had gone to... London would have given a whole other atmosphere.
Oh, it would have given it a look that was... It would have
almost too real.
Yeah, it would make it so that you'd say, well, wait a minute, the other stuff didn't look... You know,
you'd be introducing a new look three quarters of the way through the film. It would be very visually disturbing, I would think.
Gene, of all the films that you've done, which is the one in which you take the most personal pride?
Well, this certainly has a lot to it. There's no question of that. I also like A Star is Born, and I like Lay Girls, and all of them were nominated to the Academy. But strange enough, and it's interesting, they were all musicals.
Mm-hmm.
We did a lot of pictures that weren't musicals. Blondie Junction, Heller and Pink Tights, and others.
Do you think that the people working today could produce a musical like the MGM musicals or like My Fair Lady? Or do you think they could do that today?
Well, being of this period, you like to say no, they couldn't. You know, there's such great talent out there. You know, talent doesn't end when you go a little older. But I don't think they could because there's not the will of the producing parties to slow down, to do something that has no backings or special effects, on and on. This is the beginning of that pub crawl. We're in one pub.
I'm getting married in the morning.
Right.
But the incredible thing is, at least in my experience, there is nobody with the frame of reference anymore.
A lot of the directors have learned from video and not from
right.
film.
See, there's a tempo that Cukor and other directors of that period had. And a style, and it was of a period where you didn't have email, and you didn't have computers to spend most of your time with, and you didn't have thousands of commercial hours in which cuts are a 50th of a second. You know, everything is so moving, so there's no time for leisure. Although I see, you know, I'm on the Foreign Film Committee at the Academy, and I see foreign films that are like this, that are like a cute part.
I haven't been corrupted yet.
They had me come over to Denmark for a week to talk on production design. The director who had me come over said that he wanted me to explain to them how we make movies in Hollywood. They have no such thing as a production designer. They just work the director and the cameraman as a team. And he was curious hearing about how the third party came in.
How would this have been made without a production designer?
Well, the cameraman and the director would do it, and the choreographer. You know, it's like a think tank, and you throw out ideas. You never know whether it'll work or not work, but you're free to talk. The results are the result of a lot of careful thought. This is a different color, as you can see. This has got sort of the orange in it. That's Our Lady that was down in the basement.
Mm-hmm. No, well, she was up in the window.
She was at the window.
Oh, the window, that's right.
Drug me or jail me. Stab me or mail me.
And some of this is done with cutting in the camera that you can end one scene and then pick it up. Identical piece, but you're in another area. See the beer mugs? That's sort of cutting in the camera. And when he dances on the curb, then you cut to his feet, and you cut to his feet, and he's up on top of a piano. That's what I mean by in this one, where he does a little dance here. Watch his feet. So the editor had nowhere else to go. That was it. We shot that, then we shot this.
It's a wonderful cut, though.
There's many, many more of these in there that very seldom you don't
see. Well, it's almost like that cut from the return from Ascot to the night of the party.
Yeah. Right.
There's a wonderful example of that in Lawrence of Arabia.
There was one where you just went from
another
one, the head to the other.
Where you have Arthur Kennedy giving his business card in the beginning of the second part of the film, the assistant to Faisal. He hands him the card. You get a close-up of the card in the man's hand, and then you go back for a medium shot, and you have Faisal holding the card.
Uh-huh.
It's all set up that way.
Yeah, it's not new, but it works when it works. Cukor had a rule that we could make suggestions and do things that would push it a little bit, but whatever it was, don't get caught at it.
is reeling down to bed now. Morning is smearing up the sky.
London is waking.
Now, is this exterior again?
That's back that exterior street just for a little bit.
Good luck, old chum.
Needing this. Be coming out of the pub early in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Tired. I love where he takes his glove off. You caught that little action?
Mm-hmm. Off the long hand.
Yeah. No vaudeville guy. He knows how to do that very well. Then the end, putting the... I think that's Hermes Pan's idea. The lily that went in.
That is the Western Street.
Yeah, that's the same. We just filled in the ditches that I dug out earlier. Because he's going through that little area where the maypole was.
Vigory, didn't she even say where to send her clothes?
I told you, sir. She took them all with...
Vigory! What's the matter? Here's a confounded thing. Eliza's bolted.
Bolted?
Bolted. Last night, Mrs. Pierce let her go without telling me a thing about it.
Well, I'm
deaf.
What
am I to do? I got tea this morning. I like that coffee. I don't know where anything is.
I don't know my appointments are.
And of course he can't sing now because he doesn't have a tie on.
No, he just says, brown, brown, brown.
Did you bully her after I went to bed? Well, the other way around. She threw the slippers at me. I never gave her the slightest provocation. The slippers suddenly came bang at my head before I uttered a word. She used the most disgraceful language. I was shocked.
Well,
I'm deaf. I don't understand. We've always given her
he
every
gets dressed so he can sing the reprise of White Bear Woman.
For God's sake, stop being dashed and do something.
What? You like the alligator over behind her head?
The alligator is wonderful.
You can't give Eliza's name to the police as if she were a thief or a lost umbrella.
Why not? I want to find the girl.
It's really a male house, you know. There's nothing feminine in the whole...
Well, you know, I was thinking about that because the bathroom upstairs where they clean her up is very feminine bathroom.
That is, you're right.
And that was a guest room, wasn't it?
Well, that's how we can explain it.
Absolutely.
But it was ideal for Audrey to be able to...
But the water is still running.
Still good.
Well, but they had so much steam in that room, it was hard to tell.
I should say about 5'7". Her eyes... Oh, let me think now. Her eyes...
Brown!
Brown, yeah. No. No, a hair. Oh, good Lord, let me... Well, sort of nondescript, neutral sort of...
Brown!
Do you hear what he said? Brown, yes. No, this is her residence, 27...
Wilfred Hyde White's a terrific actor of that British school where they're all so good. This is another set on the stage floor.
But there's one thing where he says,
Mrs. Pierce?
Yes, Mrs. Pierce. Is that a flub when he does that? He says, Mrs. Pierce.
He sort of forgotten her name and she walks out.
Yeah, but I love this. You know, he calls one of his old friends Bougie.
Mm-hmm. Well, now he can sing.
See, he's got the tie-in.
And you can see the microphone sitting in there.
And the straightness of the tie, it doesn't wiggle
like that. I have an old school chum at the Home Office. Perhaps he can help. Think I'll give him a ring. Whitehall 7244, please.
Harry had trouble with my shiny wood.
But women are irrational. That's all there is to that. Their heads are full of cotton hay and rags.
Yeah, but right then there was a scene right behind where he sat down and did a reverse on on the telephone. There was a hot spot on the wall behind him.
Well, there were some close-ups earlier in the film on the rounded staircase where it was really kicking off a lot of light. But it was there, and it wasn't distracting. It was
just natural.
Yeah, and also, if we were doing a murder mystery, this would all be inappropriate. The lighting is proper for this particular kind of a theatrical story.
Men are so
it's
honest,
light and
so thoroughly square,
clean,
eternally noble, historically fair. But when you win, we'll always give you a back a pat. But why can't a woman be like that? Why does everyone do what the others do? Can't a woman learn to use her head? Why do they do everything their mothers do? Why don't they grow up? Well, like their father instead. Why can't a woman take after a man? Men are so pleasant, so easy to please. whenever you're with them. You're always at ease. Would you be slighted if I didn't speak for hours?
Of course not.
Would you be livid if I had a drink or two?
Nonsense.
Would you be wounded if I never sent you flowers?
Never.
Well, why can't a woman be like you? One man in a million, they shout a bit. Now and then, there's one with slight defects. One, perhaps, whose truthfulness you doubt a bit, but by and large, we are a marvelous sex. Why can't a woman take after a man? Because men are so friendly, good-natured and kind.
Seeing the film today, is there anything that you would do differently?
Yeah, I'll take the oil out of the remembering scene.
If I forgot your silly birthday,
not necessarily have the voice of the king, but not really. No, I'm just kidding. Some of the scenes that aren't as good as other scenes. I would have liked to have been able to bring on the rain gradually, but that's something you can't do. The only way that you can do that is photographically, by maybe having a spray on a puddle. Because once you start rain, it's full size.
You never considered doing it digitally at that time?
Yes, I did, but nobody was really ready for it yet. I was ahead of my time.
Gene was way ahead of his time. They were wonderful together. They really played off each other extremely well.
Wilfred Hyde White drank a little and played the horses like mad.
Righto, good, thank you, thank you.
He wasn't much of a dancer, as you could see in The Rain in Spain.
He
just about got through that scene.
Yeah. He was much better taking 5 pounds up to the bookie.
Well, I do hope you find her, Colonel Pickering. Mr. Higgins will miss her.
Mr. Higgins will miss her, eh? Blast Mr. Higgins. I'll miss her.
Pickering?
Was the atmosphere cordial on the set? Did everybody get along?
Absolutely. It was a pleasure every day. The only sad part was I was the one that was coming into the stage, Covent Garden stage, and there was a car sitting out there, had the radio on. And they just said that Kennedy had been shot. So I took the word into Q Corps that Kennedy's been shot. Then everybody, of course, turned on the radios and the grip trailer and all and found out what the story was. And Q Corps couldn't say anything to the crew, so Audrey Hepburn got to the mic and made a little speech that your president has been shot. I don't think we worked the rest of that day, and then the next day was a holiday in Hollywood. Thinking something women never do. That's where Warner asked us, saving money, had the key people come in and say that it was adding up to quite a bit, but he never gave an amount, and we never did anything differently. And he appreciated it, I think. You know, this was his epitaph. This was his picture. Of all the films that he produced and all, he kept his name up front on this one. This was his production. And it
shows. It really shows the quality is there.
Woman. I think he was generous and kind to.
Do you mean to say that after you've done this wonderful thing for them without making a single mistake, they just sat there and never said a word to you, never petted you, or admired?
I think the first one I made to ask about what time of day, which is the one after this, and then there was the question of what color is the white, because you can go different ways.
But you went just right. The walls are the color and shadow of what that white was. And then where the light hits the furniture, for instance, the white wicker and all, that's white, which gives us a nice tone to the thing.
But the green pops out, the pink in the dress pops out.
All of this is right out of books of the period, all of the great things. But I love the swinging gates. The design on the posts of those gates repeats itself in that panel. Mm-hmm. Then I would like to have in my own place that little niche for the fireplace and the little seats where he grinds his teeth. That's the only thing you guys didn't put in the right sound for teeth grinding.
Let me ask you, when you design all of these fantastic rooms for all these films, do you spend the same amount of time on your own home?
No. Fact is, I'm always embarrassed to have anybody over. I'd rather take them on a set.
You've seen the Star Wagon.
I just live in my house. I don't.
Gene has two Star Wagons.
Two back to back.
I have books all over the place. And we just live there, raise two boys there. I hate a decorator look. Most of my friends, good production designers, art directors, you go in their house and they're marvelous. They're like a set. They really look great.
He always showed me that he
Roman
felt
or whatever one that they decide. I just look like a house, a track house.
You know, you can look at a film like this even on video, and it just has that Super Panavision look to it. Grainless, velvety.
Yeah, but everywhere you have an indication of a scale. In a class I'm teaching, we do continuity sketches. And they have a tendency to do a little comic book look to their, because the sketches are little, everything that's in it is little. And I'm taking them this next time a book on Tiepolo, who did those great ceilings all over Rome. Great paint. And everything has a scale, even if you look at it in a little space. So I'm trying to teach them that you can do this in a little space. It's a matter of scale and understanding proportion. And by the way, my simple goal through everything is I'm a shape snatcher. Everything to me has to have shapes and reduced down maybe to three proportions of things that are all just abstract proportions. When I look at something, even as complicated as this, I can divide it. This is badly divided because it's right down the middle. Two halves of that picture should be one third and two thirds. I think that, you know, you think in terms of abstract shapes of what will work well.
You know, it was interesting. A few weeks ago in the New York Times, there was an article on portrait painters.
Well,
where every portrait, whether it was done by Picasso or Gainsborough or, well, no matter who it was, the one eye was always directly down the center of the canvas.
Talking
about. Well, that would make sense because that certainly would put the picture off center that way.
And it was either the right eye, the left eye.
It would never be the nose.
There was always one eye, and they used a dozen examples of how, in great paintings, that the canvas was divided by one.
Yeah, but see, that would always mean that the head was not centered. If you just have one eye in the center, that means the other two-thirds of that face is on the other side, and the weight is off-center.
But it was even on a profile. If it was a semi-profile, the eye was down the center.
That's interesting.
It was incredible to see that, but a lot of that seems to be...
Well, see, all those artists got together, and they decided
it wasn't. But I think set designers must have done that, too, because they always divided their sets into two-thirds and one-third, right?
Yeah, well, the designer certainly did, if he knows that, knows how to do that.
But I can get along without...
There's some nice moments here.
I know you can. I told you you could. You've never wondered, I suppose, whether I could get along without you.
Don't you try to get around me. You'll have to.
So I can, without you or any soul on earth. I shall miss you, Eliza. I've learnt something from your idiotic notions. I confess that, humbly and gratefully.
Well, you have my voice on your gramophone. When you feel lonely without me, you can turn it on. It has no feelings to hurt.
Well, I can't turn your soul on.
Ooh, you are a devil. You can twist the heart in a girl just as easily as some can twist her arms to hurt her. What am I to come back for?
For the fun of it, that's why I took you on.
And you may throw me out tomorrow if I don't do everything you want me to.
Yes, and you may walk out tomorrow if I don't do everything you want me to.
And live with my father?
Yes, or sell flowers, or would you rather marry Pickering?
Oh,
I wouldn't marry you if you asked me, and you're nearer my age than what he is.
I'm sure when you're through with the picture, you guys, dialogue ring
line of dialogue
comes out of your mouth.
We have conversations using the lines of dialogue.
From all the different films.
Doesn't
necessarily make sense, however.
But when Bob stands up and says, I'm Spartacus, we don't really believe him.
I want a little kindness. I know I'm a common ignorant girl and you're a book-learned gentleman, but I'm not dirt under your feet. What I did was not for the taxis and the dresses, but because we were pleasant together and I
But isn't it nice to have a picture where the skin tones are important, not the reds and orange and yellows
and
backgrounds?
The difference between us,
really is.
More friendly
but
like.
It is really instructive to hear you speak about it.
That's how I feel.
And the nice thing is 50 years from now, when... I mean, you'll be over 100.
That's correct. 50 years from now, I'll be 100.
You'll be over 100.
101.
A student can pick up this DVD, assuming that someone has, you know, stuck a few players around. Now listen to you explaining these things.
Yeah, I don't think good taste is going to change. I think less is more, you know, all the little rules that we learned over.
But what do you see here? It's white, you have the blue of the chair, you have the apples, you have her dress and a little green in the background.
Yeah, but you have space for your actors to act and to...
And depth in the set.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dimension.
And it's like if you're designing a ballet set, the worst thing you can do is do like a Picasso set behind them where you don't see the dancers. You look at good ballet backgrounds and their hanging cloth is better than anything. Well, the same thing applies when you're going to do certain dramatic scenes. You really can't have it.
Well, it's interesting. You look at the
wall. A lot of detail, but subdued.
I was just going to say that if you look at the wallpaper, it's a very intricate design, but you hardly notice it.
Yeah, there's my swinging gait. I love that.
Was there anything that Cukor said not to do, anything that you did and he objected to and changed?
On the first picture, A Star is Born, maybe a little bit, because we didn't know each other. But as time progressed, I knew him enough to give him sets that he would come on and shoot.
Look at the lighting here, the way the palms are. It gives it such an incredible dimensionality. Both in color and in depth.
What a dominated fool to think you were the earth
and everything is in focus.
What a fool I was, what an aggravated fool.
This is a song that Audrey could never sing.
But every song is so right. It's almost like an operetta. I mean, when she says, there'll be spring every year without you. I mean, there's so many great lines. And
again, based, as you pointed out, on Shaw's
story.
That's what he wanted to say at that time.
There'll be spring every year without you. England still will be here without you.
That was pre-recorded also. I remember two earphones just listening to the soundtrack as it had been recorded by her. I'm a little vague on that, except that I just remember sitting there to earphones and just waiting until my cue came along and just having heard her speaking and then going from there and doing the singing portions.
It was interesting that the estate wanted those lyrics included in the music, and I think it must have been a tremendous challenge to Lerner and Lowe, and as a result of that, they came up with something that was just brilliant.
Yeah, I think it pushed Lerner, he was a genius anyway, but it gave him a challenge that he lived up to, but it was really interesting because it makes a story rather than a musical with words. It really tells the story from beginning to end.
But similar situation in Camelot.
Yes.
If you look at Camelot.
Right. He was an amazing... You know that he had a terrible habit of biting his nails to the point where they bled. So he would go around the lot. You could follow him like the crumbs that somebody passed out so they could find their way home. You could follow the white gloves to find Mr. Lerner. He would have them on and then he would have the urge and he'd take them, throw them off and bite his nail and put them back on again, the editor's gloves.
There's an interesting story that Nancy Olson, I think his wife, tells on how they came up with the title to I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face.
Yes, it's a little self-serving.
Mm-hmm.
You wonder, has she fine-tuned it a little? But anyway, it is a great story.
How do you spell
it
again?
True.
Goodbye, Professor.
You say you were in jail for how long?
Not seeing
me again. Mother! Mother!
What is it, Henry? What's happened?
She's gone.
Well, of course, dear.
Look at
what
the color
did you expect?
It is. It's very neutral with just the...
Yeah.
Just really the green.
The warmth. You know, I don't think in terms of color.
So I
think
shall.
In terms of warm and cool. And so I paint that way and design sets that way.
Oxygen burns.
You're going to have warm faces. You have sort of cooler backgrounds. Even though that's a warm white in the background compared to his face, it's sort of cool.
Well,
and when you look, you can find blue if you want it.
I have my own soul.
My own spark of divine fire.
Bravo, Eliza.
Gladys Cooper was wonderful in those scenes.
That's where you want to know what time of day it was when you walked out that door. This is the reconversion of Covent Garden. Quick story, I had my assistant come in, put leaves in there. And I came back just before Harrison was come over to see if he would shoot here or not. And I came in, and the place was just full of leaves. And I started screaming at poor Ed Graves, and get that broom and get the crew there and get rid of these leaves. And I went around the block and came back, and he'd done an awful lot. But it was perfect when you see in a moment where he put them. I said, leave them, Leo. See the piles?
That is perfect.
Isn't that great? I came back and I said, hey, that's terrific, Ed. Because I was nervous whether Harrison would buy this or not. They went out in the mountains, cut these trees off for me overnight and brought them in, dug a hole and set them in there.
So trees were harmed in the making of this motion picture?
No, maybe that was where they got them, where they were clearing them out for a tract house or something. Or a freeway.
Maybe they're actually roots, and then they replanted them somewhere else.
You know, this shot is very reminiscent of some of the shots we're seeing in Rear Window, where you see the house in the front and the alleyway with the dimensional activity in the background.
In Rear Window, there's a taxi cab that goes by in the background, and they had to use a miniature car
to make it look right. That's Mac Mullen at his best. He was a terrific designer. He did that famous picture, Elephant Walk, too. Remember the movie?
Mm-hmm, sure. Isn't that the one that started with Vivian Lee and ended with Elizabeth Taylor?
I think so. I think that's the story.
You see that all that activity
went back there. Otherwise, you know, you could just paint the last half of this. Mm-hmm. You could be on a vacuum.
Our husband has his breakfast in bed.
Rex, watch your finger.
In a year or so, when she's prematurely gray.
But you see, if I was doing London in a murder mystery, I wouldn't design it like that at all. See how neat and clean and no dust, no dirt.
But you'd have bodies strewn about.
Something, yeah, you'd do some bits and paper and stuff. But you do this version of a musical, that's why I say you just open it up, but not too much, and keep a certain mood that is reminiscent of the theater. This is where you can see those windows are very narrow compared to what they would really be on the door's full size.
But just the subdued lighting would give you a totally different atmosphere here.
Well, it's like the situation when they started colorizing, and there's a colorization job that was done on It's a Wonderful Life. And you have that whole sequence where Jimmy Stewart comes back to the town after it's become this honky-tonk-eyes area. Is that a word, honky-tonk-eyes? It works, though.
Yeah, I liked it.
And if you look at an original print of the film, it's dark, and it's dank, and it's ugly. And you look at the colorized version, and in order to get the color in there, they had to brighten the whole thing up so much.
Like a carnival.
It loses everything.
In my first thing I ever did for Charlie Powell in colorization, Buddy, too, I can't think of Buddy's
name. Buddy Young.
Yeah. Anyway, it drove me mad because the color would run under the white shirt collars. The one I'd worked on was that Miracle at something.
Miracle on 34th Street?
Yeah. That was the first colorization.
That was horrible.
Terrible. The system didn't work. That was the only thing I really did. I think I got out of it right after that. But I would go in there and be the critic.
Just lost all respect for you.
I don't blame you.
I think we should leave this part out.
I made this just to make up for that. No, that was after this. That was after this. And by the way, they never did what they told me they were going to do. Cukor's Camille.
Oh.
Luckily.
But the costumes
something in the air
were different colors to photograph the way that they wanted them to photograph.
Yes.
At what point in the shooting was this...
That's the photograph of Gladys Cooper there,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. At what point in the shooting was the last scene done? Was it early on, or was this shot in continuity to some extent?
To some extent. I think we were near the end of it when we did this.
There is a shadow At the end of the scene, just before Audrey walks in, there's a shadow that you see coming in on the right side on the floor, which one would think would have been Audrey coming in, but then she comes in and it's not her.
No, that was me.
That was you.
That was me. Was there a concerted effort made to shoot this in sequence?
Yeah, except again, we had to make some changes to help get Audrey out of there.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I don't think this was the last scene, because Audrey wouldn't have been able to come into it.
Were you there the last day of production?
Yes, and then stayed on, and Jack Warner fired me, told me to get off the lot, and then he called me back. But when he fired me, he says, when your name is on the water tank, that's when you can change the cutting after I've approved it.
Giving lessons, not him. I heard him say so. Well, I ain't come here to ask for any.
Have we seen the shadow yet?
My money's not.
No, it's coming up.
Go elsewhere.
Good enough for what?
No, you'll see it in a second.
For you. Now you know, don't you?
Yeah, the one that approaches on the carpet. That's where the term foreshadowing comes in.
I want to be a lady in a flower shop instead of sitting at the corner at Tottenham.
I thought it was where they say, "Who knows the shadow do?"
He said he could teach me. Well, here I am, ready to pay, not asking any favour, and he treats me as if I was dirt. I know what lessons cost as well as you do, and I'm ready to pay. I won't give more than a shilling. Take it or leave it.
It's almost irresistible. She's so deliciously low, so horribly dirty. I'll take it. I'll make a duchess of this draggle-tailed guttersnipe.
I'll wash my face and hands before I come, I did.
It's a rather stagey ending.
Shaw hated this. You know, in his ending, she marries Freddie in Shaw's ending.
Isn't
it? In his preferred ending.
We get a lot of comments on how sexist the film is. And yet,
it's acceptable because it was done with good taste. Not to knock anybody. It's like Archie Bunker, maybe. You don't get mad at Archie. But he is. The idiot he is.
Well, this will give you some idea, these restoration credits, how many people work with us on this. It's not just two of us sitting in a room.
I appreciate it, Jim.
There you are, Gene.
Yeah. I would rather you had called me YouTube. It's a little more elegant.
Strangely enough, this film was the first experiment with DTS 70. And as a result of the work that we did on this, we were able to use DTS 70 on Vertigo.